This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. James Vollmer. Today is August 20th, 2010. I'm in Lubbock, Texas in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Mr. Vollmer is joining me by phone from New Jersey. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Well, why don't we begin with a little bit of biographical information. First of all, when and where were you born? When and where?
Okay, I was born in 1946, February 6th,
okay.
In Montclair, New Jersey.
All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names?
Yeah, I should say Glen Ridge because the hospital I was born in, the obstetrics part was in Glen Ridge, and that's what my birth certificate says.
Okay, yes, sir. All right. Well, could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names, and what did they do for a living?
My mother was, her name was Helen Walmer. Excuse me a second.
Sure.
Okay, and my father's name was Carl Walmer. He was an immigrant to this country I guess he came in 1924.
Okay.
From Germany. He was a technician at Bell Telephone Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was a housewife. But she was also disabled.
Okay. Yes, sir.
She was also one of the first, not one of the first, but one of the few college graduates at the time. You know, women just didn't go to college that much.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Well, did you grow up there in New Jersey?
I grew up in Bloomfield.
Okay.
I've lived all my life here with the exception of my vacation in Southeast Asia.
Yes, sir. All right. Is Bloomfield pretty close to the city?
Well, border on Newark, and which is the largest city in New Jersey.
Okay.
It's not the capital, but it's large. And as the crow flies, we're 13 miles from the Empire State Building, directly west.
Ah, okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about, about growing up and what that was like for you?
Well, as I said, I was. I grew up in Bloomfield. I attended Bloomfield Public Schools all through from kindergarten to high school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, what else to tell you. I hung out with a bunch of guys, and we did the normal things that teenagers do.
Mm-hmm.
We just had a reunion with those people, and we hadn't seen each other, I guess, in some of them anyway, in 50 years. So it was quite an experience.
Mm. Yes, sir.
Oh. We have my friends is a actor. He's semi-famous, I guess. Have you ever seen Deadwood?
Yeah.
On HBO.
Right. Yes, sir.
That series, do you remember a man named Charlie Utter?
Sounds familiar.
Wild Bill Hickok's friend, he wore a bowler hat and stuff.
Okay, yes, sir.
Well, that's Dayton Cali is his name, and that's who was one of the boys that hung on a corner.
Huh, all right, how about that? Huh.
And he was in a couple of other things, too. John from Cincinnati, he's currently in the Sons of Anarchy on FX. He plays Sheriff.
Huh, okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well,
I'm an only child, by the way. I have no brothers and sisters, and I kind of liked it that way, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
No competition.
Right, right. All right. Well, as a kid growing up, did you have any interest in the military at all? Had you had any relatives who had served in the military in World War II or anything like that?
Well, I did. My uncle was in the Navy. He was on a destroyer that was sunk off Guadalcanal.
Hmm. Yes, sir.
Kamikaze attacks. Yes, sir. Kamikaze attacks. And he and about five or six other people were the only survivors.
Oh, wow. Wow. All right.
I've always been interested in the history of World War II, and I'm a history major and a political science major.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, World War II always interested me, and I always, mm-hmm. I guess had an affinity for the military.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, as you were growing up, of course, as the Cold War began to heat up, did you pay much attention to it and what was going on in the world as far as U.S. foreign policy was concerned?
Well, when you're 14, 15, or 16, you really don't care much about those things.
Sure. Right.
I didn't become interested really in all that stuff until I was around 17 or 18, and Vietnam had recently started, and that started my interest, I guess. It sort of piqued my interest.
Right. Yes, sir.
And I was sort of always involved in politics, but it was really by osmosis. My parents were very much involved in Republican Party politics here in the state.
Okay.
And in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And although they were never in public office, they were behind the scenes kind of people.
Okay.
And as a result, I became somewhat interested in politics, although I never ran for public office until this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm currently running for town council.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. What year did you graduate from high school?
Graduated high school in 1964.
All right. And upon graduation, what did you do at that point? Was it on to college or?
No, I attended night school for a while because my parents made me.
Mm-hmm.
But I had various jobs. I was a groundskeeper on a golf course. I was a truck driver. And then I got drafted when I was 21 years old in 1966. It was January of 66. Or January of, I'm sorry, December of 66.
December of 66, okay. All right. Could you talk, a little bit about that experience, what was your reaction to getting the draft notice, and what was your family's reaction to that?
Well, being that my mother was severely disabled, and at the time my father was retired,
mm-hmm.
Almost retired anyway, and I figured that I wouldn't go. So I really didn't think about going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But then after my basic training at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, they immediately sent us down to Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And at the time, Fort Jackson was the training base. There was there in Fort Polk were the Vietnam training bases.
Okay.
I still didn't really think that I would ever go to Vietnam, but I was wrong.
Right.
And I tried to get out of going. I was put on a congressional hold. I went through my congressman at the time to see if he could help me. And a week later, I was on an Air Force jet to sunny South Vietnam.
Hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Before getting into Vietnam, once you received your draft notice, how long did you have before you had to report for induction?
I believe it was About 3 months.
Okay. All right.
2.5 months, 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And could you talk a little bit about the day you were inducted into the military and what that was like and what memories you have of that?
Well, it was very interesting. The most interesting part of it was that after some initial testing and we were all told to line up and count off by fours.
Okay.
And, you know, I was number three, and, you know, my buddy was number four, and when we all got done counting off, the people in charge said, all right, all the number fours, please step forward.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. And they said, form a line, go down the stairs, and go downstairs and get on the bus outside. We're now going to be members of the Marine Corps.
Hmm. Wow. Right.
So I just missed that. I was a number three, so.
Right. Yes, sir.
But that was the most memorable part. But other than that, you know, you're scared. You have trepidations on what's going to happen and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then we all got on a bus and they drove that bus down to Fort Dix.
Mm-hmm.
So when we arrived at Fort Dix, the whole place was filled up with National Guard people.
Okay.
So there was no room in the basic training unit.
Right.
So then they told us to get on another bus. Didn't tell us where we were going, but just get on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
So we got on a bus and drove, you know, that afternoon and through the night and ended up in Fort Bragg in North Carolina. And that's where we did our basic training.
Mm, okay.
All of our training people were airborne. And I guess I don't know whether being a Marine would have been better or not.
But, right.
Needless to say, that was an experience. I think I was, 220 pounds when I went in.
Mm-hmm.
The basic, and when I got out of basic, I was 180 pounds. So.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Right. I lost a few.
Yes, sir. Well, before getting into a little bit more of the training aspect of it, had you followed, you mentioned a little bit of it, but had you followed the developments in Vietnam pretty closely at that point? And if so, had you formed an opinion on the war at that
point? Well, not really. And because don't forget, at that time, the war was really in its infancy. It didn't really didn't bother anybody until I guess it was I forget what the unit was that suffered mass casualties in the Yadrang Valley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were soldiers once and young.
Right.
That group.
Yes, sir. The first CAV.
Yeah. That was the original. I guess the starting point of where I said, well, maybe I don't want to go to Vietnam, or
mm-hmm.
I don't want to, you know, go in the Army. But.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, could you talk, I guess, a little bit more about basic training and what it was like for you? I don't know, just something about the daily routine of basic, if you don't mind.
Now you're really pulling back some memories here. Right? You know, basic training was, I don't know whether it was interesting or I don't know the best way to describe it, but it was what I did like about it was it really made my opinion of the Army better off, and the reason was that the Special Forces, that was the home of the Special Forces Training Unit.
Okay.
And in the Special Forces, everybody was treated equally. I remember going by on a truck, we were going through the firing range one day, and we saw people on police call,
mm-hmm.
sergeants, majors, captains, lieutenants, privates. You know, they're all out there, you know, doing police call. I mean, by picking up cigarette butts, cleaning the area.
Right.
And it was all run by a sergeant.
Hmm.
At the time, and that was interesting.
To see the officers out there too.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it was nothing like regular Army. It was totally, and that sort of boosted my opinion a little bit of the Special Forces, and I was even thinking at one time of joining them.
Mm-hmm.
But then you had to go to air. You know, you had to go to you know, airborne school and you know, do that sort of thing. And you know the old saying, there's two things that come out of the sky. That's bird crap and paratroopers.
Right.
So,
right. Yes, sir.
But basic training was you're totally programmed into a way of life and a way of doing things that you had never done before. Like you couldn't throw your underwear around, or you know, you had to, you know, regularly shower, and you had to eat three times a day, and you know, you were regimented.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I guess. I don't want to say programmed, because you weren't. Well, maybe I was a little bit. Regimented, though, is a better term.
Okay. All right.
And then really after basic training, I thought we would, you know, be allowed to go home on a 2-week leave.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever, but instead they told us to get on that other bus.
Mm.
And that other bus ended up in Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Ah, yes, sir.
I went right from basic to advanced infantry training.
Right.
And went through the whole Vietnam training, I guess, facility. And I was assigned to heavy weapons infantry, which was 11C10, which was a mortar, trained in mortars.
All right. Yes, sir. All right. Do you have many memories of your of the drill instructors there? And if so, what was your impressions of those guys?
Well, I did, and we all were really scared of our drill instructors when we first went in, because they were, you know, they were tough as you see on TV today. You know, they tell you to, you know, what to do, what not to do, and whatever. But at the end of the training period, they were, you know, they were like our fathers at the time. They were super guys.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them.
Right. Had most of them...
Both in basic training and advanced infantry training.
Okay. Yes, sir. Were they all Vietnam veterans themselves?
As a matter of fact, no. Most of them were, but others were Korean war veterans.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right.
Most of the people at advanced infantry training in Fort Jackson were Vietnam veterans.
Okay. And was that training, was it focused primarily on Vietnam, or was it?
Yes, it was.
Okay. All right.
Totally focused on Vietnam.
Okay. All right. Well, did you feel overall that the training was good as far as preparing you for Vietnam? I guess as best that it could.
Yes, I thought it was adequate. My main concern was operation of weapons, because I wanted to be able to protect myself more than anything,
mm-hmm.
and that was, you know, that was some of the things we learned. We even learned how to operate some of the enemy weapons that they had at the time.
Mm, okay, sir. Was this mostly field training, or was there classroom training as well?
Mostly infantry training. There was classroom training too. And what they would do is give you classroom training initially, and then you would go out and experience some of the, what you would learn in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Or at least they try to, how could they make South Carolina look like Vietnam?
Right.
That was the most difficult part. But mm-hmm. other than that, it was basically classroom training followed up by actual, live training, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, going through basic and through AIT, did you feel that you were adjusting pretty well to the military lifestyle?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't. Don't forget, this was in 1967 and early 1967.
Mm-hmm.
And the height of the protests, didn't really occur at that time, although there was some,
mm-hmm.
but not as much as happened later on.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Before moving on from training, are there any particularly memorable moments or funny moments, anything like that, from any of your training that sticks out in your mind that you could possibly mention?
I really don't think so. I'm trying to... I know we were, in advanced infantry training, we were put on alert because the Newark riots were occurring, and other, I think that was that Martin Luther King when he was assassinated?
No, that was 68.
No, that was later. I forget what it was.
It was the riots.
I guess it was the riots in Newark, and they were afraid any other cities that it would spread to the other major cities. And we were all put on alert to go into Columbia, South Carolina, in case it happened there.
Mm, okay.
But it didn't happen.
Right. Yes, sir.
So. Oh. And that was another interesting fact, too. I mean, as far as the races, there were black people in our unit and white people. And the main thrust of everything was, there's no such thing as the color barrier in the Army. I mean, man next to you, whether he was white or black, was, protecting you just as you were protecting him. So
mm-hmm.
I like to say that the color aspect of everything was really OD.
Mm, okay. Right. Yes, sir.
And not black or white.
Right. How about when you stepped off of the base there in South Carolina, did you notice much of the racism? Did you notice any there among...
I never noticed anything. Even, I mean, a lot of our drill instructors, too, were black also.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
But I never really saw any of... Except once I saw, there was a couple guys got drunk and... I think it was from the hills of Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
and he started in with another guy who was black, and they had a fight, and then we pulled them apart, and the next day they were back to being best of friends. So, no, there was no overt racism at the time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Well, at the end of AIT, was it at that point that you finally... received the assignment and learned that you were going to be going to Vietnam?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I was scheduled to go to the 1st Air Cavalry Division.
Hmm. Okay.
So I said, oh, Jesus, here I go, jumping out of helicopters, and I really didn't want to do that, but we had to do it anyway, so...
Mm-hmm.
But that's when I tried to get out of going to Vietnam. That's when it hit me that I was going to Vietnam, because even at that point, up until that point, I didn't think I was going to go
mm-hmm.
because of my family situation and whatever.
Right.
So I was granted leave, as everybody else was, for 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
before we had the report. And that's when I applied for my congressional hold. I was put on congressional hold because I called my congressman and tried to get out of going at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was assigned to McGuire Air Force Base to await the, you know, in Fort Dix to await the decision.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then about 4 days, 5 days later, the decision came through, and they said, get on that plane over there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I ended up in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I was originally scheduled to go to the 1st Cavalry, so I really didn't appreciate that.
Right.
When I got to, you want me to go into now, is when we got to Vietnam?
Well, if we could talk first a little bit, I guess, about the trip over and what that was like for you.
Well, it's like I was flying in a tube, no windows or anything. It was an Air Force Starlifter.
Okay.
And we flew from McGuire Air Force Base to Elmendorf in Alaska.
Okay.
And that was a stopover of about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they had to refuel. Some other things, and that was interesting. We landed, it's around Anchorage, and you could see all these mountains, snow-capped mountains around it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had never really seen snow-capped mountains like that before.
Right.
So that was interesting. Then from there, after our brief stopover, we flew to, I think it was Dakota in Japan.
Okay.
And again, we were there for couple of hours. We ate some, you know, big fettas, and we you know, made a pit stop and got back on the plane and ended up flew into Tonsonut in Saigon.
Okay.
Oh. And I do remember vividly when they opened the door of that plane, the heat and humidity, you know,
hit
me right in the face. I mean, it really... You know, you really realize where you were.
Right. Yes, sir.
So.
All right.
Flight over, though, was really uneventful. All you did was basically sleep, and that's all you could do. You couldn't walk around. You were, you know, and it was like flying in a tube. You couldn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do anything. They didn't have movies at the time, you know, to show you.
Right.
They didn't have stewardesses bringing you drinks or whatever, so...
Mm-hmm. Right. How long of a flight was it, do you think?
I don't know. Long flight, I know that.
Right.
I would guess probably around 8 or 9 hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, with the stops and everything, it was probably longer than that.
Right. Yes, sir. Okay. All right. Well, once you... finally arrived there at Tonsonut. What took place at that point? What was the in processing like?
Well, once we were at the air base and got off the plane, we were formed up and again told to get on other buses.
Mm-hmm.
All of these buses had screened windows, and you couldn't really see out. And later, I found out that was to prevent anybody from throwing grenades or something in through the windows or.
Mm-hmm.
Hurting us. And then and we drove from Tonsonut Air Base to a place called the 90th Replacement Battalion at Long Bid.
Okay.
This was a clearinghouse for all people that were entering Vietnam at the time. And once here, we received our uniforms, clothing, because we really had, you know, our advanced infantry stuff on, and those uniforms were not applicable to Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So we received, you know, all of our clothes and equipment, excluding weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We also were assigned a barracks, and we all, you know, it didn't matter who we were, it was all, you know, all people from all different places, and I guess they did it alphabetically, because I was assigned to a unit, and a lot of people were at the end of the alphabet, you know, last names, so.
Mm, Okay.
We didn't stay with the people we were all on the plane with either.
Right, right.
Once here, we were assigned the usual duties, KP, that sort of stuff. But that was, we were only there for about 1 or 2 days. And as I said, my original orders were to go to the 1st Air Cavalry. And mm-hmm. I expected, you know, they had formations twice a day where they would, you know, call out your name and tell you the unit you were going to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Well, a couple of days later, they called out my name, and I expected them to say 1st Cavalry, and I was all set to go.
Right.
And they said 9th Division.
Mm-hmm.
We all, you know, we those of us that were signed there, look at where the hell is the 9th Division? Nobody ever heard of the 9th Division before.
Right.
So, you know, the sergeant was, I said, hey, Sarge, where's the 9th Division? Oh, he said, right down the road. Well, I knew Longman was right, you know, near Saigon.
Uh-huh.
So I figured, oh, beautiful. You know, garrison duty of Saigon, that's, you know.
Right.
You know, decent, at least decent duty.
Mm-hmm.
Until I found out that the AO of the 9th Division was the Mekong Delta.
Ah,
area of operations of the 9th Division was the Mekong Delta.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And so we went to... We were sent to the old reliable academy at Camp Bearcat, the head of the 9th Division at the time, where they operate out of.
Okay.
Camp Bearcat was called Bearcat, but was also it was really Camp Martin Cox. It was named for, I guess, one of the first soldiers that were killed in the 9th Division. But everybody called it Bearcat.
Mm-hmm.
And once there. We were assigned by our MOSs. Well, no, we weren't. We were all different MOSs at the time.
Okay.
We were assigned to barracks. We received our weapons at the time, our M16s and anything else that,
mm-hmm.
you know, we were carried. And then we went through an in-country training again.
Okay.
This time it was the real thing. They showed us... you know, booby trap procedure, all the procedures that we would go through, what it was like, how we should handle the people, and in general, you know, Vietnam training itself and what we could expect.
Mm-hmm.
And it was much more realistic. And at the end of the training period, we would all go out on a maneuver, I guess.
Okay, like a patrol or something.
Yeah,
or?
we would right, but it was larger than that.
Okay.
And we would experience what it was like, you know, outside of the main base camp, what it would be like, and what we could expect in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really right next to the base camp, so it really wasn't that much of a problem. However. You know, we had to dig foxholes. We stayed in the foxholes. We had to watch out for the, you know, the monsoon rains would come. The rains would come at night or whatever. We'd all be wet and muggy, and it would be really, you know, there's no bathrooms. We'd have to, you know, dig latrines. You know, all of the stuff that, you know, you wouldn't have to, you know, you couldn't experience in a main base camp.
Mm-hmm.
No showers. You know, that was for 2 days. And going without a shower for a couple of days really bothered me, but
mm-hmm.
I learned to live with it, I guess. And then we went back to the base camp and back to the facility where we were staying. And at that point, all of us were assigned to different units.
Okay.
Within the 9th Division.
Right.
And I was... Runner came in and said, listen, a bunch of people are assigned to a unit which was the 3rd of the 39th Infantry, which had just ran into a big ambush down there, and they need their replacements really bad.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Jesus, here we go.
Right.
So, and then a few minutes later, someone came in and they were asking for volunteers for a new unit involving airboats.
Mm-hmm.
And my hand went right up. They say never volunteer.
Right.
Well, I did, because I figured, you know, if I'm going to get killed, I'd rather get killed riding than walking.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Especially through all of the mud and the slime and the wood, because you were always in the mud and constantly in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So my hand went up, and I was, you know, selected as one of the candidates to, well, they had some interviews with us to determine whether we were, I guess, the right kind of people that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you know, when I was going to night school right after high school, and I had almost a year of college.
Okay.
And so that, I think that kind of helped me too.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to tell you about that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's how we got involved. That's how I got involved in airboats.
Mm-hmm. And I believe, didn't you mention in your book that you talked to the guy about race cars or?
Oh, yeah, that was part of the interview. One of the things was, well, one of the questions I thought was kind of stupid is, what would your parents say if you got killed?
Ah, right.
And I said, what the hell do you think they'd say?
Right.
And then another question was, which was interesting, was, what is the most dangerous thing that you ever did?
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted to get into this unit, so I said, well, I was into drag racing at the time, but not, you know, a full-fledged person that did that, but I
right.
sort of lied a little bit and said, oh, I used to drive a dragster.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, wow. And then he started asking me about that, and thank God I knew a little bit about it. He
right.
didn't know, he was a major, and he didn't know anything about it.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So I got into the unit anyway, so.
Uh-huh. Right.
I attribute that to, then we were all pulled out of where we were supposed to go and given a separate barracks and told to sleep, and because the next morning early you'd have to get on a plane and you'd go TDY, which is temporary duty, which everybody liked at the time because, you know, you figured you'd go someplace and your pay would be increased.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, until we found out that the TDY we got was really in Vietnam itself, with the special forces who did use the boats.
Ah, okay.
And who trained us all on the boats.
Right.
Well, I was kind of looking forward to that because I knew, you know, from basic training, you know, what the special forces was like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt a little bit better about it. And that's where we got on a Caribou, which was an aircraft that was built to land in small places.
Mm-hmm.
And off to a place called Khao Lan, which was, I guess, somewhat west of Saigon, about halfway through the country.
Okay.
Didn't take us long to get there.
All right.
And we were met there by a special forces sergeant, and he was our training officer, and he escorted us to the facility that they had, and that's how we started training on the airboats.
Okay. All right. Well, could
the
you...
airboats, by the way, were like the boats in the Florida Everglades.
Yes, sir.
Airplane engines on the back.
Right. All right. Well,
and by the way, I didn't even know what an airboat was really when I volunteered.
Right, right. How many soldiers would crew an airboat? How many people would be on the boat?
You would have a gunner and a pilot, and you could take a Vietnamese or a Thai soldier with you, and one other person.
Okay. All right.
Basically, you know, and I say that because they were smaller, and you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could take, you couldn't take any more weight on the thing because you'd reduce the speed
okay.
of the boat.
All right.
And it would become sitting ducks. So.
Right, sir.
Which I'll get into it a later later date. Something that happened later on.
Okay. Yes, sir. Well, speaking of maintaining speed, what was the top speed for them?
About 40 miles an hour.
Okay. All right. So you guys would generally try to operate at that speed then when possible, or no?
Well, sure, because that was your best defense.
Uh-huh. Right.
Was speed.
Okay.
But, you know, it's funny. We were never allowed to do anything, during the training period, never go that speed until the end.
Okay.
And as we were training, they did put two Americans plus the driver on the boat because they were operating slow, and we had to learn how to drive the boats, and we weren't allowed to open them up or go faster. You know, I would say about a week, 2 weeks later, after we learned the essentials
mm-hmm.
of the boat itself.
Right.
And then we were taught different tactics to use. One of the tactics was towards the end, when we were allowed to jump over rice paddy dikes.
Okay.
And the only way you could do that is if the dikes themselves were wet.
All right.
So what you would do is you would go very fast to the dike, towards the dike, make a 180, and spray all sorts of water up on a dike, turn around, and then you right over the dike you'd go.
Okay.
Thinking a book, I described it like, like a goose going right over the right over the dike. That's what you would have to do. But that was just one tactic.
Uh-huh.
We were most effective because we weren't with the special forces. We were with the regular army. They only trained us.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
And they trained us in their tactics and what they would do. But we really didn't use that many of their tactics when we went back to our regular army.
Okay.
Positions. We were most effective in night ambushes.
Okay. Right. And were you guys trained on night ambushes during this time period?
No.
Okay. All right.
We were trained basically in the tactics they used of recon, of some assault.
Okay.
Areas with the special forces. By the way, after we learned the basics, we then went to one of their A teams, which was located near the Cambodian border.
Okay.
An area called the Plain of Reeds. And I should say, let me back up a little bit. Once
sure.
we were allowed to go full out with the boats and drive the boats. Like they should. We all became instant airboat junkies. We loved it. I mean, the speed and the wind in your face was spectacular. I mean, we all, as I said, we all became fans of the airboat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So anyway, we went up after our initial training. We went up to a place called Don Phuc, which was an A team. Base up in a plain of reeds.
Okay.
Right near the Cambodian border.
Yes, sir.
And the trip up there was interesting, too, because we had to go on the Mekong River. And that river is so expansive and so massive that we had to hug the shoreline because we would get swamped if we... And you couldn't go fast because of because it was rough.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the ocean.
Right.
And ships would go up that river and back that river up to Phnom Penh in Cambodia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And to see a ship go by, and you're in this little piece of crap airboat.
Right.
And, you know, these huge ships go by. And you had to be careful, too, because their wakes and stuff could swamp you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So anyway, we all made it up there. and we turned from into an area that bordered on the plain of reeds, and it was a huge area. I mean, it was. I said in my book it was magnificent, and it really was.
Mm-hmm.
Because the colors and the wildlife, you didn't think anything about the dangers of it, but you know the beauty of it was really spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And you know you're going 40 miles an hour through through this area,
right?
And it's really an experience. You learn to keep your mouth shut too. That's another thing. Because if you had your mouth open, you know, you would get hit in the face a lot of times with bugs.
Right.
And whatever, and, you know, I guess that's where people learn how to eat grasshoppers or something.
Right.
Anyway, it was an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got to Don Fook, and we operated out of this unit. As a special forces operator.
Okay.
So we would go on recon, take the boats out to recon an area. We would take the boats out to check out some sandpans or that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
One time we were shot at from the border between Cambodia and Vietnam was really ill-defined at the time.
Okay.
And, well, ill-defined in the respect that we knew basically where not to go.
Right.
Cambodia, and that's where they always used to shoot at us from.
Okay.
And, you know, you couldn't shoot back because it was Cambodia.
Right.
And if there was a Cambodian guard post near there that could see you, you know, then you had to, you know, be cool, wave at them, and, you know, do your own thing. But mm-hmm. as you got on, you know, longer in the guard post, the guards left for some reason or whatever, then you would go in to find out where they were staying. You know, a lot of times they stayed right close to the border. They had their own little camp set up.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get them, and then you would get the hell out of Cambodia.
Right. Yes, sir.
So I guess we were in Cambodia, and you know, before the incursion under President Nixon.
Right. Yes, sir.
And, you know, about four years later, 3 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But don't, maybe you shouldn't write that down.
All right.
It's in my book, so you know, if they wanted to arrest me, they could.
Right. Yes, sir. Well, let me ask you this. I know you mentioned during the training aspect, one of the things they were teaching you guys about was about booby traps and things against using against the airboats. Could you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. They if you were going fast, they used to set up claymores.
Okay.
Claymore mines.
Mm-hmm.
And pop them off as you would go by, but you would, for some reason, the timing was never, you know, great on their part.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times what they did was they would string piano wire across, you know, a canal or, you know, a small stream.
Mm-hmm.
Where you couldn't see it. And if you were going fast, you'd have some serious trouble.
Right.
Well, the special forces put a piece of angle iron. They welded a piece of angle iron to their gun mounts.
Okay.
And they were taller than, you know, when you were sitting in the seat, you know, it was taller than you. So if piano wire did hit,
mm-hmm.
You know, it wouldn't affect you.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started hooking that piano wire up to claymores on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you were going fast enough for some reason, you would set off the claymores, but you would be by them by the time the shrapnel or whatever would get to you.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you were going full speed.
Yes, sir.
you're going slow or whatever, and you did that, you'd be in a world of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
World of hurt.
Right. All right. Another thing I wanted to ask you about. I know in the book you talked about being introduced to the Hmong people. Could you talk a little bit about them and your impressions of them?
Yeah, the Hmongs were Chinese and Cambodian mercenaries.
Okay.
Sort of a mix of mainly Chinese, I guess, left over from World War II, who had fought on the nationalist side.
Okay.
Chiang Kai-shek.
Right.
They sort of migrated into Vietnam and Cambodia in that particular area. And yeah, the army also utilized Montagnards. They were similar to the Hmongs themselves, but they were mercenaries that the special forces had hired to work with them and form an army to help us in Vietnam, you know, in those particular areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the unit that we were trained in utilized many of those Hmongs. They were really the people that would go out there would be one special forces man and two or three Cambodians on the boats when they would go out on a mission.
Mm, okay.
And this A team we went to was basically staffed totally by, I think there was about four special forces personnel there, and the other 30 were these Hmongs.
Oh, okay.
And they were excellent fighters, and you know, they knew how to fight. It was like the special forces. They knew how to fight a war.
Mm-hmm.
None of this namby-pamby crap.
Right.
You know, you can't fire at this one, you can't do that one. They would just go out and fight the war as it should be fought.
Mm-hmm.
So that was beneficial to all of us, too, because we learned, I guess, how to really fight a war.
Right. Yes, sir. All right.
Without basically any restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It doesn't mean you go out and kill villagers. We didn't do that, and they didn't do that. But you know, they had a program called a Chu Hoi.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And if you would capture Viet Cong or whatever, you would go into this reindoctrination program, and then he would become what they called Kit Carson scouts or whatever.
Okay.
And become and to help you, you know, fight against their former compatriots.
Right.
Which was a lot of crap, because what Charlie would do, you know, he would shoot the hell out of you, and then he would run out of ammunition and throw down his gun and holler Chu Hoi.
Mm.
And you couldn't pop him. You had to take him into, you know, as a prisoner and turn him over to you know, the reindoctrination people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I thought it was a load of crap, because you would go through the training, learn how to handle American weapons and stuff, and end up you know, becoming a, you know, a fifth column in
mm-hmm.
in the army, to the army.
Right. Yes, sir.
So, but anyway.
All right.
But with the special forces, you learn what to do and really what not to do.
Okay.
And that's something that I think was... Well, I'm here today because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, these...
I like to think so, anyway.
Yes, sir. Well, these operations that you went on with the Special Forces guy and that with the Special Forces guys in that Plain of Reeds area, was that where you had your first encounter with the enemy?
Right, that was the first time. You know, it's funny too. On our way up there, before we got there, we were told just, you know, there's a whole bunch of people in sampans and houses on stilts, you know, house here or house there with stilts, but there's people all around it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume that if we weren't new or weren't trained, that those people would have been questioned and attacked and whatever, because they were probably all Viet Cong.
Uh-huh.
But we were told just to keep going, Don Kuk and the training base. But, as I said, the first time we were really in a fight with them is when we would get shot at from the, you know, from the water or from the reeds or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God nobody was hit or hurt, but that was basically the first time.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. And I remember you you mentioned in the book the first time that you believed you were shot at by the enemy, it actually wasn't. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. We were on a small canal. This was during our initial training.
Okay.
We weren't allowed to go fast at all, and there was three of us there. And I heard a gunshot, and next to me was, a bullet hit the water and splashed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we were all shot at.
Right.
And so we immediately they did a whole complete, to the village and just did a sweep and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Come to find out later that it was the guy sitting next to me on the, on the boat had his finger on a trigger.
Right.
Buffer found into the water. We didn't say anything because, there would have been hell to pay.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
But that, that night, and as I said, I thought that was the, and I was driving a boat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right.
It's funny because of the sound, you can't hear where the sound is coming from.
Right.
All you can hear is the sound.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, before talking about what happened after this initial training, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the unit itself and some of the guys in the unit. You don't have to go into specific names or anything like that if you would prefer not to, but if you could talk a little bit about the guys and some of the personalities in the unit, if you don't mind.
Well, in the unit itself, I guess people came from all over the country. They were from all over, from Texas.
Okay.
From New York, from Wisconsin, from California, from Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody had their own, grew up in different parts of the country. But we all basically came together and we all became, fast friends. I mean, it took longer than that for us to come together.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to see what their perspective of life, is and why they were there and it was like my best friend on that I became with was a guy named Danny. He was from San Diego, California.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Navy brat. His father. You ever see the movie, what was the movie with Robert De Niro and Cuba Gooding?
Oh, Men of Honor?
Men of Honor, I think.
Yeah, right, yes, sir.
The Robert De Niro character was Danny's father.
Really?
Yeah, he was just like him.
Huh, uh-huh.
And for some reason or other, we just clicked, and as they said, we became boat partners and friends.
Mm-hmm.
To this day.
Right.
And actually we became friends with everybody, at least I did anyway, with just about everybody in the unit.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
There was a couple of people that I didn't particularly like, but
mm-hmm.
they were still members of our unit and there were you know, they would help us just as we would help them.
Mm-hmm.
It became a, you know, there were, well, how could I say it? We're like brothers. I mean, you know, we fought with them, we bled with them, we ate with them, we did everything
mm-hmm.
together.
Yes, sir.
So, as I said, we became a very, very cohesive unit.
Right. All right. So, so morale was pretty high then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, nobody wanted to be there.
Right. Sure.
But a lot of people didn't want to be there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How many people served in Vietnam? 5 or 6 million?
Yeah. Something like that, yes, sir.
I would say probably around, you know, 3/4 of them didn't want to be there.
Right. Sure.
But probably more, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Well, once you... Not to back up too far, but once you first arrived in country, did you receive any of, were you welcomed immediately, or did you receive any of the new guy treatment that you tend to hear about, or how were you treated being a new person to the unit?
You know, we really didn't have that, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
All of our unit were all new guys.
Okay.
And all of us were in the same boat, so to speak.
Right.
And the only people that we didn't get any of that. I mean, we dished it out as we got replacements when people showed up, but we never received that type of treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Okay. Well, I guess getting back to the timeline here, once you completed the training with the Special Forces, where did you go at that point?
All right. Well, we went back to Camp Bearcat.
Okay.
We were kept separate, and our boats had not arrived from the States yet.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to keep us on water. So they sent us to a line company, which used whale boats to carry supplies and men. You know, little outboard motor boats.
Okay, yes, sir.
For supplies and whatever, and that's what that had to do with airboat training. I have no idea.
Right.
But that was that sort of cemented our knowledge that we were in Vietnam, because we were under a lot of stress. That's where I got wounded, as a matter of fact.
Mm, okay.
I was in country, you know, what, a month, maybe a little over a month, and our platoon got mortared, and as I was running to a bunker, a mortar shell went off right next to me.
Mm, yes,
it landed right next to me.
Right.
Knocked me over, and I did a somersault and got up and kept on running to the bunker. Got into the bunker and was trying to catch my breath, and all of a sudden I felt something dripping down my back, running down my back.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is that? You know, sweaty, no pain, no nothing. And then I took off my shirt and black vest and whatever, and I says, okay, you've been wounded, so then they put a bandage on it, and that was it. I was lucky because it just went in just in my back and I guess hit a rib and bounced off.
Mm.
Almost came out under my arm. It was like a bulge under my arm.
Huh.
Didn't quite go through.
Right.
So when our boats came in, finally, initially, I had one of the docs at Bearcat take out the shrapnel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
You know, cause as I said, it was bulging out, so.
Right, right.
And he did, just a little incision and out it came.
Mm-hmm.
So.
As a result of the wounding when it initially happened, did you have to be medevaced or anything like
no,
that?
Okay. No. In fact, put a bandage on, and we went on a mission the next day.
Mm, okay. Right.
They were questioning whether I could go or not, but I convinced them I was ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
We all wanted to go on a mission.
How long did you remain doing this type of work before the airboats arrived?
I guess it was about another, I'm not sure, 3 weeks to, yeah, about 3 weeks later, our boats came in from the States.
Okay. All right.
Then we had another problem.
Okay.
That time we went back to Bearcat to get our boats, and all our boats came in with 50 caliber machine guns mounted on them.
Okay.
Problem was, in order to shoot the 50 caliber machine gun, the boats had to be stationary. And if you were driving along, you know, and fired the 50 caliber machine gun, the recoil of the thing would flip the boat up on its side.
Oh, wow.
So that was the first thing we had to change. We ended up putting M60 machine guns on them.
Okay.
Not all of them. In fact, we still had some 50s. In fact, my boat still had a 50 caliber on it from on our first mission, which was, well, there was a machine called the tree crusher that was used to pulverize vegetation around a base camp that they were building.
Right.
So the enemy couldn't hide. And this machine got stuck in the mud of the wrong side.
Okay.
And there was no protection on the outside, you know, covering the outside of this machine. On the inside, it was close to the camp, but it was still far away.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically had no protection.
Okay.
And needless to say, it was a very expensive piece of machinery.
Right.
I think there's a picture in my book.
Yes, sir.
You see a person walking in front of a tree crusher, so you see how big it is, how massive it is.
Right. Yes, sir.
And how expensive they were.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, we were on guard positions in our boats around the tree crusher because this is all in the Rungsat Special Zone, which is all mangrove swamps. And what happened was it was clearing brush, and the tide went out, and they didn't realize it. And the tide came back in, and they were almost underwater.
Okay.
So.
Right.
And then they couldn't move because the water and the mud got into all of the moving parts of the engine and stuff, and as a result, it was finished. You know, finished. Until they pulled it out to clean it out.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that was our first mission. We were assigned guard duty of that unit. We had five positions all around it, not all around it, but at least on a half moon.
Okay, yes, sir.
Position. And during the night, I had heard movement, you know, the proverbial cracking of the twig, you know, when somebody walks or whatever, and I called it back in. I said, hey, listen, I hear movement out here. Is there anybody out here that shouldn't be? And they said no, but come back to the boat. So they recalled all the airboats into the tree crusher itself,
okay,
into that area to provide really close protection.
Right.
And about 5 minutes after we had pulled up to the tree crusher and settled in, all hell broke loose.
Yes, sir.
And the base camp that they were building was attacked by the Viet Cong.
Okay.
This was the World Thai Army had this particular company-sized base camp that they were building out in the thing. And the Viet Cong wanted to make an example of you know, how they could go in and wipe them out.
Mm-hmm.
However, the tables were turned on them because they attacked this camp, and the camp had just got everybody back into their bunkers because of, I guess, you know, because we heard movement. And so they were just to be on the safe side. So everybody was in their positions when they attacked, and they did a real bunch of damage to the Viet Cong.
Mm.
30 to 40 VC were killed.
Wow. Yes, sir.
Or wounded.
Yes, sir.
So.
Did either you guys or the Thais take any casualties?
No. The Thais, believe it or not, the Thais did take some casualties, but they were minor.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And that was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
For the ferocity of the attack.
Mm-hmm.
And when they attacked, I jumped on my 50 caliber machine gun because the enemy was in between us and the base camp when they attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see the tracer flashes from the enemy that, you know, where they were fired from. So I got on the 50 caliber and started firing at those positions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Then they called out from the camp, you know, stop firing because some of your stuff is going into the camp.
Right.
So some of your fire is going in there. So lay off and just only fire when you know you have definite targets.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So we stopped firing, and all night long, you know, bullets are coming out from the camp to us, towards us, so we had to really hunker down. And, Viet Cong were trying to destroy the camp, but they had no success. And I think maybe from our firing initially, or from our initial reports to the campus, we probably got everybody, you know, saved.
Mm-hmm.
Not saved, but everybody ready for any attack or anything.
Right. Yes, sir.
All
right.
But that was an interesting night, too. I mean, especially when you have bullets, you know, flying right by your head and you can hear them and
mm-hmm.
you see the tracer rounds coming at you.
Right.
And you really, really couldn't do anything because you weren't sure where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Was this the firefight you mentioned in your book that wasn't too long before Tet? Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. All right.
About a week or two before Tet.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. Well, could you talk a little bit about, I guess, about your impressions of the Thai soldiers? And did you guys work with them very often?
How it started was when our boats came in from the States, we were billeted right next to the portion in Bearcat that was allocated to the Thai Army.
Okay.
And they had seen these boats, and they were operating in the Rung Sot area,
mm-hmm.
which was southeast of Saigon, which was total mangrove swamps.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, it's like those airboats, you know, we want those.
Right.
And because they were an ally of ours, any ally that we had in Vietnam got priority of just about anything they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So we were assigned after they saw what, you know, what happened with the tree crusher, whatever, they wanted to use us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we were assigned to that very same base camp. You know, that was run totally by the Thai. The only Americans were, they had an American advisor with them.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for the first, up until May, I guess it was. And this was in January.
Okay.
From January to May, we operated with the Royal Thai Army.
All right.
So, and that was an advantage too, because you didn't have to put up with any of the crap that you would have to put up if you were, you know, regular army.
Right.
With spit shines, you know, and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
The only time that would happen is when we would go in to the into Bearcat for showers or a hot meal or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I can't keep saying whatever I shouldn't
say. That's all right. All right. Let's see.
So yes, we did work with the Royal Thai Army, and they are excellent soldiers. They were excellent soldiers.
Okay.
And we really, really cemented many friendships with the Thais. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the XO of the Thai unit was the son of Thonaut Kittikachorn, who was the Prime Minister of Thailand at the time.
Wow, okay.
And as a result, when it came time for R&R, for me, I went to Thailand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because these soldiers all kept extolling the virtues of their country, how nice it was, and I really wanted to see that. And I really fell in love with Thailand.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
As much as anybody can fall in love with something for a week.
Right. Right.
But the Thai people were very good people.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell in love with them.
Mm-hmm.
From working with them and being in the unit.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, how could you guys communicate with them? Could many of them speak English?
Many of them did speak English.
Okay.
The ones that didn't would really say things to the ones that did, and they would translate for us.
Mm-hmm.
And we would try to learn a little bit of yeah, but, you know, other than, you know, Sawadee Kap, you know, how are you, and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Really didn't make an effort to learn the language because so many of them did speak English.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I guess...
I learned a few phrases, but I can't even remember them to this day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they were just basic...
Right.
Basic phrases.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Okay. Well, before getting into to Tet, I guess if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about just a little bit more about your duties and the daily routine in Vietnam and what life was like out in the field.
Well, daily life in Vietnam, whether you were out in the field was taking up with very mundane duties, very boring duties.
Okay.
The biggest factor was the object, I guess the Army, was to keep everyone busy.
Okay.
In doing things. Well, when we were at the Thai camp, we ended up having to build a bunker to house all of us, to house our platoon.
Okay.
And we had to fill, it seemed like, thousands of sandbags to make a large bunker.
Right.
And when we weren't on a mission, you know, night ambush mission or patrol mission, we would come back and we would have to fill sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
And we had just gotten done, again, I don't know whether there's pictures of that. I think there's pictures of that in my book also, of the pyramid that we had to end up building.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, there is. And you can see from the pictures how many sandbags we're talking about.
Right.
But we had just gotten done with that, and about a couple of weeks later we were moved to a different area and had to bulldoze the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
So that was kind of frustrating too, but you know, that's what life was like in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
When we would go back in for into the main base camp and for shower or hot food, we were then assigned duties that had to be done at the unit itself, such as KP or perimeter guard in the main base camp.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And you know, after a combat mission or out in the field, you want to come back into the main base camp and relax, but they didn't let you.
Mm-hmm.
The first sergeant of the, we were assigned to the, let me back up a little.
Sure.
We were working with the TIEs, but we were assigned to a unit called the 15th Engineering Battalion.
Okay.
And this was, the reason for this was they had 5-ton trucks
mm-hmm.
and small cranes, which they could, which would facilitate moving our airboats around.
Okay.
So, as I said, that's why we were assigned to that unit.
Right, yes, sir.
And that unit didn't particularly like us too much.
Okay.
Because we were basically infantry people, no engineer. We were like, they treated us, we were like prima donnas.
Right. Right.
We were getting the medals, we were getting priority on certain things, mainly because you're working with the TIEs. But we were not well liked by the engineers.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
As a matter of fact, as we needed replacement sergeants or whatever, they would replace those sergeants with people from the engineering unit, and they would become our NCOs.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to, you know, they thought they were hot shit.
Right.
And yeah, they were all shake and bake sergeants. By that I mean they were, shake and bake is the term that was given to, they needed a lot of sergeants because they kept getting killed.
Right, yes sir.
And they set up a sergeant school for people, you know, in Vietnam itself, in Bearcat mm-hmm. itself. And these were all graduates of that school.
Okay.
And that's why we used to call them shake and bake, because they go there and 2 weeks later they come out as
right, yes, sir.
And then so they knew everything.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and we were out there getting all the glory and stuff, and they resented that in kind of, you know, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes they don't blame them.
Right.
But anyway, we would go back into the base camp for showers and as I said, a meal, hot meal or whatever, and then they would assign us to perimeter guard and different KP, you know, KP duty or, you know, just in general,
mm-hmm.
you know, something to piss us off even more.
Right.
So, we didn't really like going much into the main base camp.
Okay.
We liked staying out. But we did, you know, we did like hot showers and we did like hot food occasionally.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So.
All right.
We were pretty much at liberty when we were outside of the base camp to do our own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was nice.
Yes, sir.
There was a lieutenant that was assigned to our unit that I became his driver, and we had a 3/4-ton truck, a small truck, not a 3/4, a half ton, no. Anyway, a small truck.
Okay.
Like a pickup truck.
Yes, sir.
It was assigned to the TIEs, but they let us. They let us use it. And he had a friend in Saigon. And he had me drive him, you know, after we came out of the field, we went back, he said, go get cleaned up. I want you to drive me into Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, okay. So I showered and changed and got the truck and picked him up, and we drove into Saigon.
Right.
Well, his friend was a bar girl at a hotel,
mm-hmm.
and he had a drinking problem.
Okay.
And they used to have a restaurant and bar up on top of this hotel, which overlooks Saigon itself.
Okay.
And he would see his girlfriend and get drunk and, you know, cause all sorts of problems.
Right.
I basically was there to take care of him.
Right.
Anyway, to make a long story short, the next day we went back to the base camp, and the first sergeant called me into his office, said, where were you? You were absent without leave. He said, what are you talking about? My lieutenant wanted me to drive him into Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you were scheduled for perimeter guard. And you weren't there. You were absent without leave. You didn't say anything to anybody. Well, I didn't think I had to. But,
right, sure.
But I should have, and so he said, you see these on my desk, these papers? These are papers promoting you to sergeant. And he took them and he ripped them in half.
Oh, no.
And threw them out.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, next time you're in here, you're going to be doing your shit-burning duty for every time you come in here.
Mm. Right.
And shit-burning was, did you read that part of the book?
Yeah, I did, but would you mind explaining for the recording?
Well, in the latrines in Vietnam were not in the ground. They were 55-gallon drums cut in half.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they would be placed under, strategically placed under a hole in the latrine.
Uh-huh.
And you would go into these 55-gallon drums. And every day, these drums would be changed with empty ones.
Right.
And the full ones were pulled out, and then diesel fuel was mixed with the feces.
Mm-hmm.
And you would have to stir it up and mix them, just like you were mixing flour or something.
Right.
Bowl with eggs and stuff. And then you had to light them on fire, and they would burn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you got rid of the feces, and then the barrels would be empty, and they'd be ready for the next. As the barrels were filled up, that you replaced them with, then uh-huh. you would do it vice versa. And you were assigned this duty.
Right. Yes, sir.
I don't know whether it was rarely or not, but. Unless you did something wrong, then they assign it to you, every day.
Right.
See, that was another reason we all of these duties we'd get out of because we'd be doing, we'd be out on missions in the base camp, outside of Bearcat.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
That's another reason we liked it. But anyway, that's what he said I would be doing. Whenever I came back into base camp.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I figured that would be better than Article 15.
Right.
They'd fine you for money, fine you for that, and go on your record, and you didn't want that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So anyway, I don't think I ever burned another thing of crap again because we were either always on missions or doing something else.
Yes, sir.
You really never had the time to yourself. You were always doing something.
Okay.
And again, as I said, maybe that was better because you didn't have time really to think about, getting the hell out of there and wanting to get out and dangers
mm-hmm.
that you would go through. You would just do them.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Could you talk a little bit about, as far as when you guys were out in the field, what sleeping quarters and food and things like that would be like out in the field?
That's another interesting thing. Where we slept was the bunker that we had built.
Okay.
We slept in that bunker.
Okay.
Food, from time to time we would get number 10 cans of tomatoes or frozen chicken or frozen veal.
Okay.
Beef sometimes. All canned, basically canned goods.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really the one that started, I don't want to make like I'm the only guy there, but and I certainly wasn't. But I was familiar with cooking.
Okay.
And I ended up cooking a lot, like spaghetti. One night we cooked the meat, the veal tomato sauce I would cook.
Yes, sir.
Because the neighborhood I was in was an Italian neighborhood.
Right, okay.
Basically familiar with Italian food. Knew basically what I was doing.
Uh-huh, yes, sir.
We would get cans of butter. When I say cans, I'm talking number 10 cans. They're large cans of butter that was in them. And I would melt the butter and we would make oil. We would cook fried chicken. Somebody wanted fried chicken one day.
Uh-huh.
We had chicken, but they said, "Boy, I sure would like some fried chicken," one of the guys said.
Right.
I said, "Wait a minute, we can do that. Let me try and see how this will work out." So we melted the butter. It became the oil that we would deep fry the stuff in. And the chicken itself, we had some bread from one time. It was stale, and I made some breadcrumbs, and we coated the chicken, and we dropped them in. Actually, it came out damn good.
Right.
So, stuff like that. And when we didn't have food, or we would go into the base camp and have food, where we wouldn't have to cook or anything.
Mm-hmm.
The Thais, I remember one time... Thais used to cook their own food too, and they had killed a marsh deer, which is about the size of a dog, a small dog.
Okay.
And they had cut strips of meat and prepared it, to their way of. That was my introduction to Thai food, by the way.
Okay.
And it looked really good, but everything the Thais ate was cooked with peppers.
Right.
They weren't peppers that you would normally... I mean, these were really red-hot chili peppers. Everything they ate was hot.
Right.
So, try this, you like this, try that, you like... And they would give us stuff. And boy, I'll tell you, it took a long time for the burning to go away after I ate a piece of that.
Right.
I mean, it was an experience that one does not wish to have ever. I think getting shot was better than. yes, you eventually gained a taste for that, and that's true. But initially, when you've never had it before, and all of a sudden you have it, forget about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And I think I remember too that during the Tet Offensive, when our supply lines were really screwed up, what they would deliver to us was ammunition and sea rations and beer.
Okay.
And so we had a lot of sea rations.
Right.
And that was an interesting meal too. They had different varieties. Ham and lima beans, Franks and beans, little tins of pork. It's like a pork roll.
Okay.
It's like chicken. Little tins of chicken in a roll type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Chicken roll, I guess it was.
Right.
The bread they put in those cans. For dessert, there was canned peaches, canned pears, fruit cocktail, pound cake, if you can believe it, in a can also. That was a favorite.
Right.
People like that. But we would eat all of these meals, but to heat them up, what we would do is break off, we had C4, which was an explosive material.
Okay.
We would break off a little piece of C4 and put those in an empty can. And light them on fire and put the sea rations on top, and it would cook. You would open the sea rations, and it would cook the sea rations in about 2 seconds because the heat was so intense. It was a white hot heat from the C4. It didn't explode. It just burned.
Right. Okay.
That was our main method for heating the sea rations. The fruit you didn't have to worry about, the fruit cocktail or the peaches or whatever, which was decent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But most of the stuff in the cans was terrible. Peanut butter and crackers they had in cans. And peanut butter, crackers, and jelly, I believe it was.
Yes, sir.
No, it was peanut butter and crackers. Jelly we got from, you know, every once in a while somebody would get something sent from home and they would, you know, put in a tin of jelly or a bottle of jelly.
Okay. Yes, sir.
So eating, we would have to train every once in a while. The Navy operated what they called PBRs, were river patrol boats.
Right, yes, sir.
And they used to have excellent, excellent food. I mean, they had steaks. They had, you know, really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for us to trade with them, they wanted captured weapons. Well, we would capture a lot of weapons, most of them American-made. But they really wanted the Chinese, you know, the AK-47s and that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they would trade. They would trade with us for steaks. And they would give us a case of steaks for a couple of captured weapons. So
yes, sir.
Every once in a while, we would have a nice grill. We would set up a nice grill and grill steaks.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, no potatoes or whatever, and and vegetables to go along with that, but, you know, that's how we would eat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would either eat vegetables if somebody had something, then we would cut that up and eat that. But no balanced meals is what I'm saying.
Right.
That we're used to.
Right. Yes, sir. How about...
We may do.
Yes, sir. All right. I know you mentioned as far as sleeping quarters and things would be the bunkers, but how often would you guys really get to sleep? Did you just have to sleep whenever you could, or how did that work?
That was basically it. Sometimes, like in the afternoon before missions,
mm-hmm.
Before we would go out in the afternoon, we would catch a few. Then when you come back after missions, we would catch a few Z's. Anytime we could,
mm-hmm.
We could sleep. And when we would go out on the ambush positions, one of us would sleep and the other one would be awakened guard, and then we would offset. But you really never slept on these missions because you never really trusted anybody.
Right. Yes, sir.
Both sleep, so.
Okay.
Oh. But you slept when you could.
Right.
And we, you know, flip-flops were a big thing, too, because we were always in the water, and everything was always wet. So when we were back in the Thai camps or whatever, we would all put on flip-flops to dry our feet out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So, it was you may do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't, you made the best of the situation, I guess is what I want to say.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, another thing regarding life out in the field. I know you had a couple of sections in your book talking about, I guess, wildlife and insects and things like that. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the leeches and the mosquitoes and that type of thing?
If you go back, do you remember where I was wounded and we went on a mission the next day?
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
Well, the mission that we were on was, I'm not even sure where it was. All I know is it was south.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down, way down in the Mekong Delta. And it was an old estate that was all bombed out.
Okay.
It was on... I guess they grew rice and stuff at this place, and there were rice paddies all around, you know, all out to the front of this area, and on the back it backed onto a canal.
All right.
And I was assigned to go out to this rice paddy dike and guard. You know, and guard the perimeter of this camp where, you know, this state, I guess it was. They had howitzers set up there, you know, a howitzer battery.
Yes, sir.
And as I said, we were assigned to guard this perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were sitting on a perimeter. I didn't too much like the idea of going into a rice paddy. But all of a sudden, it was dark, and we were sitting there. And a machine gun opened up, a Viet Cong machine gun.
Mm. Yes, sir.
Bullets were going right over our heads, so immediately we dove into the rice paddy.
Right.
And then laid up on the dike itself, you know, with the lower half of my body submerged in the rice paddy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Viet Cong, I guess, were just using target practice, seeing what they could hit, because after a while the machine guns stopped. Called in some helicopters, air support, and they, attacked the area that where the machine guns are coming from. And that was funny too, because you would see the choppers make passes in and fire their weapons,
mm-hmm.
and as they would pull out, you would see the Viet Cong shooting back up at the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
The tracers, you could actually see the tracers.
Right.
Then they would come around again and suppress strafe the area and then rocket the area and then go right up, turn up to come around, and you would immediately see tracers from the ground coming up to the helicopters.
Mm. Yes, sir.
So that was interesting.
Right.
And all night long, we just laid on the dike with lower half of our bodies in the rice paddy.
Mm-hmm.
The morning finally came and everything was fine. And we got up out of the water and stood up and to go back into the main area where we were staying. And I felt an itch on my legs. And I went down to scratch it and I felt this long slimy thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, on my leg. The hell is that, a snake or something or whatever, and then I dropped my pants to see what it was, and all over my legs and down were leeches, and they were long. They were about six or seven inches long.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And I started panicking, and then this one guy, it was our platoon sergeant with the unit we were serving with, grabbed me and said, "Listen, relax. These are leeches." He says, "I got them too." So, and he dropped his pants, and anybody who was in a rice paddy, we all had leeches on it.
Oh, yes, sir.
So we sat there burning leeches off each other. You lit a cigarette.
Right.
These things were 7 or 8 inches long, and you hit them with a cigarette, and they shrivel up to about, or contract to about an inch long.
Huh, wow.
Then you could, they would fall off.
Uh-huh.
Because if you pulled them off, you would leave their heads in there, in your body, and it could become infected. So you didn't want that.
Yes, sir.
So you would burn them off, and then they would let go, and the blood would run for a while because it was in their spittle.
Uh-huh.
They had anticoagulants in there, which made it easier for them to suck your blood.
Right.
So, they would bleed for a little while, and then they eventually would stop.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But that was my experience with leeches, and boy, I'll tell you, the way I felt before I was, it's just like in the Humphrey Bogart movie, The African Queen.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
He was pulling a boat along in the water, and he got out of the boat, and the leeches were all on his body.
Uh-huh.
Just like that. The only difference was the leeches on his body were short. Maybe they were African leeches, or maybe that's what they did. They weren't, weren't elongated.
Right. Yes, sir.
Same way, so I know how we felt.
Right. Yes, sir.
Oh. The other animal, a lot of animals, a lot of insects, nothing big. The biggest, I guess, was the marsh deer that we used to see with the, every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
With the ties, there were mud puppies, know what a mud puppy is? It's like a like an amphibious fish.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And they lived all in these mangrove swamps, and when the tides would go out, that's all they would come out of their holes in the mud and I guess mate, you know, with other ones or whatever. That was their existence. And then the tide would come in and they would disappear. Birds of all kinds, herons, egrets.
Yes, sir.
Grasshoppers, bugs, spiders.
Right.
That was one of the famous booby traps. That's why I'm glad I was big, because I wouldn't become a tunnel rat or go into tunnels.
Right.
Because only smaller guys could do that. But that was one of the booby traps that they would set up with spiders. They would put them all in a box of some type. And then you would crawl through the tunnels and trigger something, and all the spiders would drop on you.
Mm.
Or snakes. That was another thing they used. A lot of snakes.
Right.
Little snake. What they called crate snakes. K-R-A-I-T.
Okay.
There were two-steppers. You know what a two-stepper is?
Yes, sir. Could you explain it, though?
Well, once they bit you, you would take two steps before you died.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're called two-steppers.
Yes, sir.
So you had to be careful of them. Like I said, leeches, bugs.
Mm-hmm.
The general stuff that's in the tropics.
Right. Yes, sir.
I mean, we didn't see any tigers or lions. We operated towards the coast or in the wrong spot, which was a coastal mangrove swamp.
Uh-huh.
So nothing, we weren't in the mountains or, or even elephants were there for a while.
Huh. Yes, sir. Right.
Water buffalo were all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But they used those for beasts of burden, for plowing, for harvesting. They used them. They used ducks. Ducks were all over the place, though. They used them like chickens, like we do chickens.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
All the farmers had flocks of ducks.
Right.
Trying to think of anything else. Oh, fish of all kinds. How we would go fishing, that was interesting, too, how we would fish.
Oh, okay.
We take a grenade, throw it in the water.
All right.
And it would go off, and all the stunned fish would be floating to the surface.
Uh huh.
And we would learn what fish we could eat and what fish we couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Dogs. The Vietnamese were fond of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
They would eat them.
Right.
Thais wouldn't eat them, but the Vietnamese would.
Okay.
The Vietnamese were very heavily Chinese influenced, too, and the Chinese will eat anything.
Right.
I'm not being offensive, but I'm saying that anything that walked, crawled, or flew was fair game for them to cook and eat.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, we're coming pretty close to the 2-hour time limit for today. Do you want to go ahead and take a break for today? Is that okay?
I'm still fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, only trouble is I have another interview coming up pretty soon. So.
Okay, well, that's the only thing we didn't touch on, too, is the one operation where we were in as a blocking force for the... Royal Thai Army was making a sweep.
Okay.
And we were a blocking force on the other end of them, and they would sweep towards us and hopefully push all the enemy or whatever towards us, and we would catch them in a crossfire.
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, when they were done and making a sweep, they would come up to the boats, and two of the boats, they were loaded onto the boats, and because of the weight and everything, we'd go 2 miles an hour.
Huh.
The enemy pulled a fast one and ambushed us.
Oh, really?
And that's April 10th, 1968. That's the day my platoon sergeant was killed.
Yes, sir.
And I was one of the first boats to arrive on the scene because we were up on the other end of the on the far end of the line of the canal, and they were operating towards the lower end of the canal where they where the boats would pick them up and take them back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, his boat was his boat and another boat were ambushed.
Yes, sir.
His boat was hit with a rocket. And thankfully, the RPG, the rocket, the boats are made of fiberglass, and they would go right through the boat itself and exploded in the water. But they did make a big hole, and it caught the water, and the boat capsized because of it.
Yes, sir.
Everybody in the boat was either wounded or whatever was thrown overboard.
Right.
So I came back to the... I was one of the first to arrive on the scene, and they were still getting machine guns from the enemy position. And I had moved into a position in between the people in the water and the enemy and provided covering fire while another boat came in and rescued
people. Yes, sir.
And, called in airstrikes, and they had suppressed the firing too, so the firing was, thank God it was brief, and only a couple of people in the boat were wounded. My friend Craig was on a machine gun when the rocket landed right next to him, but because it didn't go off and it went through the boat, it went off in the water, he wasn't hit from that at all.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, talk about luck.
Right. Yes, sir.
However, my platoon sergeant's head was, back of his head was almost gone because of, you know, enemy fire, probably AK-47 fire or small arms fire. And
yes,
as the boat rolled over, he was in the seat he was driving, and we never did find his body. We never did recover it.
Oh, goodness.
So.
Yes, sir.
To this day, and as a result, you know, we had a reunion in 2002 of our unit on April 10th at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Okay.
In D.C. And his widow was there. We brought her in. We invited her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she never really got the true story of really what happened.
Yes, sir.
So, but she got it at that point.
Right.
And the story is related in the book itself. At the end of the book, there's a short story called Finding Lost Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells the story of the reunion and how we connected after all the years that we... You know, after 35 years, none of us had ever seen each other except maybe one or two of us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And it was an experience that I'll never, ever, ever forget.
Right.
It was just like seeing everybody. It was just like leaving them the day before.
Yes, sir.
35 years have passed between seeing most of the people.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, I'd certainly like to cover that with you and Tet, and I've got quite a few more questions for you. If we could schedule a second session sometime, would you mind doing that?
Not at all.
Okay. This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, continuing an oral history interview with Mr. James Woolner. Today is August 31st, 2010, and this is interview session number 2. Okay, I was wondering if we could begin today, if you could talk a little bit about your impressions of the enemy, and a little bit about, if you could talk also a little bit about how they operated.
Well, the Viet, you're talking about two different groups here. You're talking about the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese regulars.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
The Viet Cong were a very dedicated group of individuals. They believed in what they were fighting for. And they were a really tough enemy. I don't know else to say other than the fact that the Tet Offensive of 68, after the Tet Offensive of 68, there was virtually no more Viet Cong left. It was all North Vietnamese regulars after that.
Okay.
Because what the North Vietnamese did was basically use the Viet Cong as the shock troops in their various attacks, and as a result, they lost a extreme, you know, most of their infrastructure.
Okay.
People. So after that, the war was prosecuted strictly by the North, and controlled by the North.
Yes, sir. All right.
And the North Vietnamese also were a very disciplined soldier. How they enforced that discipline, I don't know. The Viet Cong themselves, when they controlled different areas, they ruled by terror. That's the only way they could, get cooperation with most of the people. And as a result, many teachers or village leaders or whatever would be, assassinated or killed.
Okay.
Viet Cong. So I'm getting another call, but that's okay.
Okay,
don't worry about it.
Okay. All right. Well, did the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese operate differently as far as tactics when they would fight against you guys?
No, it was pretty much the same tactics up until towards the end, where there was more confrontation and bigger attacks. Before Tet, is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
After Tet, they sort of retreated to lick their wounds, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But they still, regional attacks in different areas, select different areas, but not a whole heck of a lot as much. And then when the North Vietnamese came in, there was much more heavier attacks in certain areas.
Okay.
In the south, in our area, there was, it was just standard attacks. No attempts, no large attempts were made after the Tet Offensive. Just the same actions that they did before: ambush tactics or isolated attacks on certain small outposts, ambushes, bombings, that sort of thing.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. You've mentioned Tet a few times. Could you talk about what Tet was like for you guys, for the guys in your unit?
Well, they did a pretty good job during Tet, and especially in blocking supply lines.
Okay.
We lived basically for a good 2 or 3 weeks on sea rations and beer. That's all they could get in, flying on the choppers, that and ammunition and sea rations. And most of the roadways were cut. They were normal supply lines were hurt, but it recovered fairly quickly. And as I said, we lived on sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
And local food if we happened to come across it.
Right.
As far as the damage they did severe damage, especially in the city. We were pulled out from our area and pulled guard duty for some engineers. Well, they in the Cholon section of Saigon, which was the Chinese section, which is where most of the attacks occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And became, I guess, infantry guys. We were a lot of us were infantry anyway, but we didn't work on the boats or on water. We just pulled guard duty in Chulon. Well, they rebuilt some of the schools, some of the buildings, but that wasn't too long. They taxed our infrastructure pretty good. It was a victory for us because many of them were killed, although it wasn't portrayed that here in the States, but it was over there. I mean, we killed a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And yes, they did a lot of damage, did damage to the psyche of the American public, I guess.
Right.
But as I said, in Vietnam, they sort of, you know, there was, like I said, there was no Viet Cong after the Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Well, not no, but there was very little, let's put it that way. They suffered a great deal of casualties.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. How long did you say that you guys remained in the Cholon area?
We were there for about, I would say, I'm trying to remember, I think, 3 or 4 days.
Okay. All right.
I mean, the devastation in that area was unbelievable. I mean, very few buildings were standing without any damage.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny part of it was that was the Chinese section of Saigon.
Right.
So.
Had it calmed down? Had the violence calmed down in Cholon by that point? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Oh. It wasn't like up in Hue where the Marines were,
mm-hmm.
where they had pitched battles in the city itself. They were either died or withdrew from Cholon itself. But in Hue, they stayed there, and it was a really a nasty fight up there. I mean, thank God we weren't up there.
Mm-hmm.
But in the south, it was different.
Yes, sir.
I guess the proximity, because up north, there was more NVA regulars that were there and more manpower that they had than they had in the south, and I think that's why they withdrew from Saigon, because as I said, many of them were killed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. All right. Was there much of a lull as a result after? After Tet, did things quiet down for a while, or did it continue along?
Yeah, they did quiet down for a while after that.
Okay.
Until they reorganized, what they had left, and they were supplanted with NVA people.
Mm-hmm.
And that really didn't start up again until I would say probably around. August.
Okay.
68. Then they were back up to full complement, I guess, or a full. They had enough people. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Do more damage.
All right. Okay. Did your unit take any casualties as a result of that?
As a result of Tet, I'm just trying to think. No. But
okay.
Just before that, when we were operating in the Rung Sot zone, with the Thais,
mm-hmm.
While we were working with the Thais in their base camp, took some casualties. I uh, before we even got the airboats, I was wounded, and two other people in my unit were wounded when we were at a place called Tantru before our boats came in from the States.
Yes, sir.
By mortar fire. They had mortared this base camp we were at a place called Tantru.
Yes, sir.
And I wasn't even in country for, you know, just a little over a month, and I got wounded already, so.
Right.
And our boats didn't even come in, but it wasn't serious.
Right.
And also, two people who were with us also got wounded. One got a slight wound in the arm, and another got a slight wound in the leg, all from mortar shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
But the big battle that we had was just before Tet. They attacked the on our first mission. We were pulling guard duty for a machine called the Tree Crusher.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pictures are in the book that I sent you.
Right.
Tree Crusher.
Yes, sir.
And it got stuck in the mud. They didn't, when they were whacking down trees, they didn't realize that the area would have, when the tide came in, it was all water. And so they got stuck in the mud.
Right.
And it was about, maybe 100 yards, 50 to 100 yards outside the base camp that they were enlarging the area, the field of fire, which knocking down some trees and stuff so the enemy couldn't hide.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, we were pulling guard duty for that unit, and we were in a semicircle around the Tree Crusher from the water side, and the Viet Cong attacked this Thai base camp, figuring that it wasn't ready yet, wasn't totally safe to be there, and they could make an easy victory.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they surrounded the camp, and they were in between the Tree Crusher and us and the Thai base camp, and we didn't even know it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We were. My boat was the top of the a semicircle around the Tree Crusher itself, and I was up on the far end, and I heard like you hear when people walking and you hear twig snap when somebody walks.
Right.
And there was all sorts of movement, so I called in thinking it was probably a patrol or something that was in back of us. And they said, no, we didn't, there was no patrols out there, and to be careful. And to come back to the Tree Crusher, they called all the boats back because they wanted us all around it just in case the Tree Crusher was the area that they were going to attack. But the camp was. But the camp was alerted, so they were all ready for anything, and then all of a sudden all hell broke loose once we got back to the Tree Crusher.
Hmm.
And that was a decisive defeat for the Viet Cong. There was about four Thais wounded in that battle, and none of them were really serious. And that was it. And there was 30 or 40 Viet Cong that were killed. There was blood trails leading off everywhere around it.
Yes, sir.
So that was our baptism of fire.
Right.
And the sad part of it was I had a 50 caliber machine gun on my boat, and you could fire it stationary, but if you were driving along, you couldn't fire it because the recoil from the machine gun would flip the boat up on its side. So anyway, I jumped on the 50 and we started firing we saw where the tracer rounds were coming from. But then we were ordered to stop firing because some of our firing was going into the camp, because the Viet Cong was in between us and the camp.
Hmm.
So we stopped and just sat there and watched the fireworks. And,
right.
It was interesting, but none of us were wounded at that, in that fight. So it was pretty good. Most of the time that we were wounded was because we were ambushed by the enemy, which was quite frequent. And once your biggest defense was speed to get the hell out of the situation that you were in. So you would do that, but if you were going up a small canal to check it out, and then the canal ended, you turned around to come and came out back out. In the meantime, the enemy would set up on you, and wow, you'd get ambushed. And we lost a Thai soldier and one of my buddies was wounded 3 or 4 times, but managed to get his boat, out of the situation. And he won a Silver Star for that, by the way. And it was he saved a lot of lives on a boat. So.
Yes, sir.
Another person was wounded again in another mortar attack, and then one of our people were wounded in a friendly fire incident. It was a short round. They fired mortars out from the camp, and this was a short round that it failed. Some of the powder failed to go off, and it came out of the tube, and it hit him in the head. It didn't explode or anything, but it hit him in the head, and he was had a severe head injury because of it.
Right. Yes, sir.
And then also in various actions, we were fairly lucky, except the one day that our platoon got ambushed when we were deployed as a blocking force, and a couple of boats were picking up the Thai soldiers after they made their sweep. And once you put weight on the boat, you're lucky you could go 3 miles an hour. And the enemy had set up in the meantime to ambush these boats, and they did a good job, and my platoon sergeant was killed. Another friend of mine was on the machine gun of his boat, was watching that, and an RPG hit the boat right by the machine gun, but went right through the boat because they're made out of fiberglass and styrofoam.
Right.
And it didn't explode until it hit the water. So he was unscathed, unbelievable. Didn't have a mark on him. I mean, the boat flipped over, and everybody in the boat was thrown in the water. But he didn't have a mark on him. My platoon sergeant was the driver, and unfortunately, he was they got him squarely in the head. As the boat flipped over, the other personnel in the boat were wounded, and the back of his head was gone. But we never did recover his body.
Oh no!
Because it went over, and tides were going out at the time. They were so swift and so fast that we just never found them.
Yes, sir.
That's one of the things that I am really sorry about. We never did bring him back.
Right.
But he was gone anyway.
Yes, sir. That happened in April. Is that when that happened?
April 10th.
April 10th, okay. All right.
April 10th, 1968. That's probably a day that I'll never forget.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Did you happen to read the reunion part?
Yes, sir, I did. I'd certainly like to talk to you about that before the interview's over with, and about how that all came together, and about how you came to write the book as well.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Another question I have for you about the Thai soldiers. How long did you guys work with them? Was it your entire tour or just for part of it?
No, almost the entire tour. It was up through, right after the ambush in April.
Okay.
April 10th. So May, they pulled, towards the end of April, or I guess it was the end of April, they bulldozed the camp and recalled the Thais, and then we no longer worked with them.
Okay.
We basically were on our own with the engineers. We would be in, we worked with a few units as, but we were more effective in you know, we would interdict traffic and inspect a lot of traffic on the rivers and the byways.
Okay.
A couple of ambushes we would go on at night. But we essentially, up until August, I guess it was, late July, or August, we basically were working on the Thong Nai River.
Okay.
Basically inspecting, and once in a while we would go out on ambush positions. We would go out on recon positions a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But no particular unit until August. And I was a short timer by that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just gotten back from R&R, and the 9th Infantry Division was moving its headquarters from Bearcat to Dong. Well, they had been in the process of doing it, but they did it in piecemeal.
Okay.
Well, Dong Tam, which was further down on the Mekong itself.
All right.
And at that time, we were used for carrying supplies to certain units. Totally not what we were supposed to be doing.
Right.
But you know, you follow orders.
Right. Yes, sir.
Well, that's what we liked about it too. When we were working on the river, we were pretty much to ourselves, and you know, none of the military crap that you had to put up with in the main base camps or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right. So. Yes, sir. All right. Well, did you guys ever have any contact with or work with the South Vietnamese troops?
Well, not really.
Okay.
I'm just trying to think of if we officially, the only people that we worked with occasionally were the, what they called rough puffs.
Okay.
That's the regional forces, popular forces.
Right.
And I don't believe, no, our airboats weren't in from the States. We were on operations out of Tan Tru and to a further town further up the river called Anyutan. And that was, you know, those are the basic people. You'd know whether they were Viet Cong anyway half the time, you know, at night.
Right.
But that was the only time. And they were basically older people, you know, old. All the young ones were either in the Viet Cong or in the South Vietnamese Army.
Okay.
So we really didn't affect them at all.
All right.
Interact, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Yes, sir. All right. How about your impressions of Vietnamese civilians? I know in the book you mentioned a few times about kids hanging around. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Every place you went, no matter where it was, there was always kids. And you know, whether it was, you know, in a base camp or in a small town, it's always the kids that would come running up to you. And you know, you felt for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were the people, I guess, most hurt by the Vietnamese War. And you couldn't help but not like them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was one kid that, when we were at the place, as I said, this place called Tran Tru before our boats came in, and his name was Tommy.
Okay.
And his father was a village chief who was assassinated by the Viet Cong.
Mm-hmm.
for not giving him rice, and he was standing right in front when both him and his mother were killed.
Oh, wow.
And we all sort of took him in, you know, took care of him, you know. We would give him jobs to do. He would take, you know, sweep up our hooch at the time, or take care of our clothes and stuff, and we'd give them to the mamasans to do our laundry if we wanted to, and then, you know, just in general.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he got to be, you know, all of us really, really liked this kid, and one day the day came when our boats came in from the States, and we had to leave, and we just up and left, and he was, you know, there all alone, and nobody to take care of him anymore, and, you know, whatever happened to him, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that was very, very hard, and I think after that, none of us befriended any of the kids like we did Tommy, because it was, you know, tough when you had to leave an area or you had to leave them behind.
Right.
So.
Yes, sir.
I mean, it's not that we didn't care, but we gave the kids, you know, everything that we had, extra candy all the time, or sea rations, or anything that we had that they needed or wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we never got close to any of the kids after that.
Right.
None of us did.
Right. How did you guys find out the story about his parents? Did he actually tell you about
it? Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
He didn't have, nobody was around, you know, so we assumed it was true, and it's tough.
Mm-hmm.
There was no other adults around that could verify that or whatever, but, mm-hmm. you know, we believed him. He was crying and...
Right.
So.
Yes, sir.
I mean, this happened about 6 months before we had gotten there. So
okay.
His father was, as I said, was the village chief, and they were in, you know, he refused to give the Viet Cong rice. So they made an example of him. That's why I say they ruled by terror.
Right.
And that's what they did, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
But a kid should never see his mother and father, you know, killed.
No, sir. Right. Well, was his English pretty good then?
It really was.
Hmm.
It really was. We, he was in this base camp, as I said,
mm-hmm.
but he was, yeah, the Vietnamese are very intelligent people, and they pick up things very fast, and picked up English very fast, and we were surprised. I mean, there was a lot of things that, you know, we would have to, you know, coach him to say and stuff, but eventually he was, you know, very fluent.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that maybe he got a job with the current government or something as an interpreter or something.
Right. Right. All right. So did he... He had already picked up some English from a previous American unit there, or from you guys?
From the base camp itself.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I got you. All right. Well, another thing I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned in the book, about becoming the unofficial medic for the unit. Could you talk a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, that was interesting. Everybody had jungle rot,
mm-hmm.
which was, you know, a form of fungus. That's why whenever you came back to the base camp, you always wore flip-flops. You'd let your feet air out and won't. But so I, you know, was very itchy, so I developed a sort of a cure, left scars, but it cured the items. And then... you know, various little little aches and pains, mm-hmm. and VD.
Right.
A lot of guys got VD. And if you got, more than twice, I think, then you got an Article 15, which was a punishment. You know, it would take away some of your pay and you'd be fined or whatever. So.
Right.
If they caught it more than once, they didn't want to go to the medics and stuff. So I happened to be friends with a medic, and he had some powdered penicillin, and he gave me a few vials of that mixed with water, and that would solve the problem. So I used that and became a medic that way, too.
Right.
A bunch of people. Not myself, I have to say this. I never had that problem, although many of the people did, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
It was interesting. And for cuts and bruises and stuff, you know, stuff like that. So, because right. I had all of the stuff for the jungle rot, the methylate and peroxide and all of that stuff, so.
Mm-hmm.
I also became the official cook.
Right.
Every once in a while, a Navy patrol boat would, come near us or come by, and they would want to know if we had any captured weapons to trade. And that's how, that one had a case of steaks, a case of chicken, all sorts of stuff every once in a while. So we would trade with them the weapons that we had captured, and then we would, have a, feast or famine.
Mm-hmm.
you would pig out when you had that ability, and then you didn't have anything for a month or so.
Right.
One time we managed to get a case of veal steaks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it's not like the veal that you get today. I mean, it's all,
right.
Army stuff. They all packed it in a big frozen box.
Right.
So, and then I made, had some tomato sauce, and I ended up making a nice veal dish.
Huh, right.
Spaghetti we had. Made that up. Fried chicken one day.
Uh-huh.
We used to have, you know what a number 10 can is? The large can.
Okay.
Butter used to come in that.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And we got some chicken, frozen chicken. And somebody said, geez, I'd like some, we should make some fried chicken. I said, yeah, but we don't have any oil or anything. And then I thought about it. We had one can of butter. Wait a minute, maybe we can melt the butter down and use that as the deep fried stuff with.
Uh-huh, right.
And we did. And so, like I said, it's feast or famine. So we had fried chicken, and then we had enough for another day.
Right.
And then we had nothing for a couple of months except sea rations, and the Thais used to, get some animals, shoot some animals sometimes, and marsh deer or whatever.
Right.
They would prepare it and make it. That was my introduction to Thai food, by the way.
Right.
And I'll tell you, they if you've ever eaten Thai food, true Thai food, it's with peppers. I mean, all the hottest peppers you could ever put on your lips. Mexican peppers leave nothing to these Thai chili.
Right, yes, sir.
And everything they make is hot. So, I remember that they had captured a marsh deer, and we were sitting talking, and they were cooking up some stuff, and they invited us, over there to have some of the stuff, and it looked pretty good. So we ate some, and as soon as they put some in my mouth, forget about it. and they laughed their ass off too, and
right.
Americans were eating a Thai food, and then they gave us a drink. They had a liquor called Mekong.
Okay.
and it was drink it. It'll make the fire go away. So we'd take a shot of that, and that was just as bad. But believe it or not, that solved the problem after a while. But you were probably drunk by that time, so you didn't notice anyway.
Right.
But it was interesting. It was interesting. As I said, why I cook this stuff, because I used to do some cooking at home and mm-hmm. before the service. And plus, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. All my friends were Italians, so I basically knew what to do, and nobody else knew anything.
Right.
Not cooking or anything. So.
Yes, sir.
Sort of migrated into that.
Right. All right.
Made the time fly anyway, instead of you're not just doing one boring thing after another.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, besides cooking, how would you, if you had any downtime, how would you spend it?
Well, there was very little downtime because...
Okay.
If you had downtime, what you would do is sleep. You were always kept busy.
Right.
Because we had the... When we were, we operated mostly at night, and so we would have to sleep sometime during the day.
Okay.
But they always kept it busy. Plus, we had a huge bunker that we had to build. We had to fill sandbags.
Right.
And that took up, believe it or not, a lot of time.
Hmm.
I was, hold on a second.
Sure.
Sorry about that.
Ah, no problem. All right. You're talking about spending a lot of time building that bunker.
Downtime, we either had to build hooches or we had to build, fill sandbags to build a bunker. And
mm-hmm.
There was a hell of a lot of sandbags we had to fill.
Right.
And we would go out, operate at night. So there was a lot of we're always kept busy, so there wasn't really a lot of downtime.
Mm-hmm.
When we went to the Dong Nai River, when we operated out there, there was more downtime. But we would make friends with the kids and play with the kids. We would help the civilians if they were doing something, building something.
Okay.
We would read we get letters or magazines. Or,
right.
Very rarely would you get books. I was luckier than most of them too, because I was a driver a lot of times for my lieutenant, and we would go places, to Saigon or different places of interest throughout, like MACV headquarters in Long Bend. So I wouldn't just be status. Wouldn't be stuck in one place all the time.
Right. Yes, sir.
So I think that's what kind of helped me, too, as far as, keeping it together, I guess.
Right. Yes, sir.
Of all of these different things that I'd end up doing. And then, as I said, I'd cook something just keep busy, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
The busier you were, the faster the time went by.
Right. All right. Did you get a chance to go on R&R?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Because we had worked with the Thais in the Royal Thai Army, and they said that how beautiful their country was, and how nice it was, and I said, well, geez, maybe I'll take my R&R, I'll go to Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, the executive officer of the Thai unit was the son of Thonon Kittikachorn, who was the prime minister at the time.
Oh, well, okay.
And if you go there, you go to this hotel, you stay here, and it won't cost you anything. It didn't cost you anything anyway, but you know, he gave us a lot of tips on where to go and what to do.
Right.
So that sort of helped. It was. I went on R&R alone. There was nobody else in my unit because we were such a small unit. We couldn't afford to let one or two people leave at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So we all went wherever we went alone.
Right.
And you would just make friends with people on the plane going there that were going to the same place as you, and that's basically what I did. Anyway, I ended up going to Bangkok, and I'll tell you, I'm glad I did. I fell in love with the city. It was a beautiful place, clean, and neat, and nice. I mean, the people were all nice. Maybe it's because I was a soldier and spend the money. I don't know, but it was. Yeah, they were all very, very. It was a great place to go.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful, pretty. What we would do is, once we were assigned a hotel, or told them where we wanted to go and whatever, and we were in a hotel. I made friends with this one guy. He was an infantryman from the someplace, I forget where he was, in one of the other companies in the 9th Division.
Okay.
And once, we were assigned to together, because it was always, buddy system, so to speak. If you were assigned, you would stick together and all through the whole place. So we would check into our hotel, and then we went out and got a cab driver and said we were interested in. He says, "Well, I know a very good place, and I'll take you to it, and it won't rip you off, and nice girls are in there." And so that's what we did.
Mhm.
And then we also hired him for the whole week.
Okay. Right.
Be our exclusive chauffeur, I guess.
Right.
And we went all through Bangkok, all around Bangkok, to the different floating markets, the different temples. It was really, and it was good because he could speak English. He was a student at, I guess, at one of the universities there.
Okay.
And he was sort of not the run-of-the-mill type, but sort of the class system is there was sort of middle class, I guess.
Okay, yes, sir.
So he was very happy to show us all around, show us where to shop, if we wanted a particular item, jewelry store, so to speak, or which shop had the best food, or which restaurant had the best food. I'm sure he got a kickback from all the places he showed us.
Right.
But it was nice to have that type of thing rather than just spend on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And the girls that we also kept those girls for the entire week.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than you could do whatever you wanted to do, but it was much nicer to have that sort of consistency.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it was safer PD wise.
Right, yes, sir.
But they were all the young ladies in Bangkok were all required, by the health department to be all checked out, because that was a major R&R center too, and that's where a lot of GIs would go.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want them coming back with anything or catching anything. So.
Right, right.
But it was nice, and time flew by. I mean, you were on R&R for 7 days, but my God, you know, it's like 3 days.
Mm, right.
And all of a sudden, you had to come back.
Right. How much time did you have left in your tour when you returned?
Well, I was scheduled to go until September.
Okay.
In the end of August and early September was my Duros. So I had just a very short time when I got back from R&R. I took it late. I took R&R, you know, later than normal. I guess most of the people would take it, you know, midstream or you know, not too long after that.
Right.
But I waited really until not the end of my tour, but I took it towards the end anyway. But I also got back, and I wasn't back too long when. The first sergeant of the unit said he wanted to see me, so I went over to see him. He said, "Listen, your father's in the hospital, and you're granted an emergency leave." You know, my mother at the time was had severe rheumatoid arthritis and was really bedridden, and my father had gone in for surgery.
Right.
I was an only child. So I said, "Hey, Sarge," I said, "you know, I only have, you know, 3 weeks left, and if, when I go home, you know, and I'll be there for 2 weeks, and then what do I have to do, come all the way back to Vietnam?" He says, "Well, you're not going to be able to clear Vietnam, you know, and because you got to emergency leave, and you got to get to Saigon and get on a plane, and your plane is at 2 o'clock this afternoon." And I said to him, he says, "Well, let me try. A friend of mine, you know, has a Jeep over here, and he can chauffeur me around." And he said, "Well, you can try." So I did, and I cleared Vietnam in about 2 hours.
Mm, wow.
And, you know, got on a plane, and I remember there was an officer that I, because you had priority, and I bumped an officer off the plane.
Right.
He was pissed. But, hey, listen, I went home on emergency leave, so.
Right.
And then after Vietnam, after I was done with my leave, I was scheduled to go to Fort Knox in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. But I managed to get that changed to Fort Dix in New Jersey, and then I was reassigned to a training company at Fort Dix, training brigade. And spent the rest of the time I had left in the Army there.
Mm, yes, sir.
And then I got an early out to go back to college.
Okay.
So I got a 3-month early out.
Right. All right. Well, before getting into life after Vietnam, if I could ask you a few more questions about leaving. Did you develop any sort of short-timer syndrome in your last days there?
Oh, yeah, we all did.
Okay.
Nobody would want to go on missions, or nobody would want to, you know. We'd always look for something to do in the main base camp. We would, you know, do everything we could not to go on missions, I guess.
Right.
Let the new guys do it.
Right. And because you guys had been created as a... Well, the unit had been created by guys coming in nearly about the same time. Was most of the guys going home at about the same time?
Yes.
Okay.
Most of our unit was.
All right.
But yeah, you know, all during during that time, as people got wounded or whatever, we would get replacements in. People for one reason or another would leave or would. Doing something else, again, replacements would come in. So by the time, though, that I was scheduled to leave, the original group, I guess it was, most of us were scheduled to leave in September.
Okay.
So I left early, and then I had to leave. I have to leave a lot of my stuff there that I accumulated over the time too, and I never did get that stuff. It was, you know, they swore they would send it to me, but I never got it.
Right.
We had the, as I said, towards the end, we operated out of Bearcat. We built the bar on Bearcat, and we just didn't go on any missions. We tried not to go on any missions. And I think we all of us were like that. Once in a while, you get stuck and you'd have to go. But you could get the short timer syndrome. You don't want to do things.
Right.
Because they're going to get you killed because you're so short.
Right. Right.
And nobody wanted to get killed towards the end.
Yes.
Nobody wanted to get killed anyway.
Right.
Or wounded.
Right. Well, another thing I know you mentioned in the book, you talked about later on towards the end of your tour that the tactics had changed somewhat as far as compromising speed.
They did. That's one of the reasons, too, we didn't want to go on, because we knew that we ended up resupplying, ammunition to a lot of troops or carrying a lot of troops.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where many of us got, in fact, all of us, not all of us, meaning me, but most of the unit, if they were wounded, they were wounded during some type of function which was detrimental to us,
mm-hmm.
because our speed was compromised.
Okay.
I guess they didn't particularly like the airboats for doing what they were doing. The regular army just didn't like them.
Mm-hmm.
So we were a bastard unit anyway, until we were assigned to the 15th Engineers.
Okay.
As things progressed in the war, and they had us do things that we shouldn't be doing, but you didn't have a choice.
Right.
So you just didn't want to, they weren't, it wasn't the same as it was, initially.
Yes, sir. All right. Well, is there anything else we should cover about your tour, anything we haven't, anything memorable, anything funny, anything like that we haven't covered before moving on to the trip home?
Did we cover the shit burning?
I think you briefly mentioned it last time. I believe so.
I thought that was a funny part in my book. It wasn't funny at the time knowing it, but it was, looking back on it when I wrote about it, it was kind of funny.
Right. Yes, sir.
The cooking. I think we covered just about everything.
Okay.
Unless there's something in particular that caught you.
Let's see. Oh, one thing I remember I was going to ask you about was pets in the unit. I know you talked
about
that.
Oh, yeah. We would get dogs, or a couple of us would have pets, pet dog, pet monkey. Again, animals there were the Vietnamese ate dog.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we would befriend one and capture one and get it out of the hands of the Vietnamese themselves.
Right.
We would have a nice dog, but then the dogs would always get diseases and stuff like the stepper.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to put them down.
Right.
And so it got to be, that was another thing, too. You made, you got a dog and you were real close to the dog. I know one of my buddies was, and his dog had distemper, and he had to put it down, and we took it into the base camp, and the vet said, no, you had to be put down. They didn't have, they had limited stuff to put the dog to sleep with.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember one thing, he says, why don't you just take it out and shoot it? And my friend got really pissed at the vet. And eventually he put him to sleep, but that was an interesting, says, you guys see this all the time, you got guns, you just do it.
Right.
It solved the problem. Yeah, he said, but who's going to do it?
Right.
And then you just couldn't do that. But anyway, I don't know whether the vet was joking or not, but he said, there's nothing you can do except put him to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
The monkey we had, that was a, I'm trying to think of where one of the sergeants got him. I guess from one of the ties.
Okay.
Just trying to, I have a hard time remembering. But they, they came and gone. You would keep them for a while, and then you would have to move, and you couldn't take them with you. And again, that became another pain in the neck. So.
Right.
Try not to do that either.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Okay. Well, let me talk about the trip coming.
That was the one that we were in an ambush position one night.
Okay.
And we heard movement. We're on a main river, and I called in a gunship.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into the area machine gunned the area and then rocketed the area. And the next morning there was a dead water buffalo there. And a farmer was screaming.
Right.
Because that was their main beast of burden and stuff.
Right.
The movement we thought was something was a water buffalo.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I guess the Army ended up having to pay for that. I think they paid for anything that they did damage to.
Okay.
But you could see that with the power of a minigun. On a helicopter, because there was a zillion holes in the thing.
Right.
So, I don't know whether that was funny. It was funny to us, but it wasn't funny to the farmer.
Sure. Yes, sir. All right. Well, anything else before coming home?
No, I think that's basically it.
All right.
I mean, there's a lot of little things, but it's hard to put it all together. It's all basically in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Yeah, there's different things that was interesting. Yeah, I'm a funny guy too. A lot of things, I'm interested in, like, nature and the way things, animals and plants.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's me. That wasn't everybody.
Right. Yes, sir.
Coming home was a real trip. As I said, I came home on emergency leave. And entirely different from the way I arrived in Vietnam. Because I arrived via the Air Force.
Right.
And I flew home via Pan Am or whatever.
Okay.
And there were stewardesses on a plane, and they took care of you, and it was interesting.
Right.
But the plane was loaded up. As I said, I had to bump this officer off there. But that wasn't the... Once you're on a plane, and doors were closed, and the plane got out a 50 caliber machine gun range, everybody what he says, you know, when you leave, there's a collective sigh of relief.
Mm-hmm.
You're out of the go, well, that's true.
Right.
And everybody just, you know, wow, we're finally out of here.
Right.
And then seeing, you know, round-eyed women, which you very rarely saw in Vietnam, was a good name to come up and ask you, you know, if you wanted anything, to drink or any soda or whatever. No booze, but...
Right.
But, you know, it was nice talking to a woman for a change.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I guess everybody was, everybody slept in. We flew from Saigon to Honolulu, and we stopped there. And I guess it was, you know, we were allowed to. We only spent a couple of hours in Hawaii.
Okay.
I guess they refueled and rearmed, and then flew from Hawaii to Oakland. San Francisco, near San Francisco, and once we were in Oakland, that was the place where, but that's where you would get all your, you know, all you turn in all your old stuff and all your jungle fatigues and all of that stuff, and you would get uniforms, and they would really outfit you for your trip home. And then after Oakland, they say, there's the cabs, get a cab, go to San Francisco, and your destination, wherever you were going.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was Newark, and off I went, and I was really, really tired. I don't remember much of the flight other than getting on, and then all of a sudden, the stewardess was shaking me up, shaking me awake, and we landing in a couple of minutes, and back home, back in Newark.
Right.
It's amazing. We were in, I remember there was this one guy that I befriended. We went from the Oakland Army Air Terminal to San Francisco Airport.
Okay.
And, you know, San Francisco at the time was hippie haven, hippie heaven.
Right.
Was a hippie there. And then, you know, if you were coming back from Vietnam, they really, really dumped on you. And,
right.
We were sitting there in San Francisco waiting for our flight, and this hippie came by, and he had his hand down his girlfriend's back of her pants,
mm-hmm.
you know, all the way, you know, in her crotch almost. And
right.
We just shook our heads, and the guy said, "What the hell are you looking at?"
Right.
And he said, "No." He said, "What the hell are you looking at, baby killer?"
Right.
And my friend, that's all of my friend. He got up, he went over to him, and he cold cocked him.
Right.
Him, and both of them went down. Because he had his hand and down at me, both up.
Right.
So I grabbed him, and I said, you know, let's get the hell out of here and go find some place to hide out for a while, because, you know, sure as hell, I didn't want to get arrested the first day back in the country. And I know San Francisco was, you know, it's not a nice place to be at that time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we did, and we were both on the same plane back to Jersey, but he was from New York, and that's the last time I saw him. That's when we got off the plane in Newark.
Mm-hmm.
Said goodbye, my parents met me, and back home I went.
Right.
My father had just gotten out of the hospital, and he had come down to meet me with a friend, with our next-door neighbor. Drove. My father couldn't drive yet, and we had he drove us back home. So, and they had moved in the meantime too. So I came back home to a different place than I was living before I went into service. So
mm-hmm.
that was interesting.
Right.
That was all right. You were back home.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit after that, I was back up on the corner with friends again. I hadn't seen for a year.
Right.
Yeah. Right up.
Sir. Did you, upon coming home, did you have any period of adjustment getting used to civilian life again?
Well, I was still in the Army, don't forget.
Right.
You know, I was, as I said, I was originally assigned Fort Knox in Kentucky, but I managed to get reassigned to Fort Dix, so a training brigade.
Right, right.
So, after my initial leave, I had to go back to Fort Dix, and I was, ironically, in the training battalion, in the basic training battalion, and I worked under a drill sergeant, and the drill sergeant did everything he could to kept trying to get to Vietnam, to go to Vietnam.
Mm, right.
And I said, Gene Sofchak, his name was, I remember, I said, you don't want to go. Do everything you can to get out of going. He says, no, I want to go. How can I train these guys? And, he says, Gene, you don't want to go. Well, he ended up going. I don't know whatever happened to him. So.
Mm. Right.
Now, he managed to get transferred, but it was interesting, training. I was the bad guy, and he was the good guy. You always have one good guy and one bad guy.
Right.
And then sometimes you would change off with the next crew or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in good shape. I used to, like I said, when I went in, I was around 240 pounds. And when I got out of basic, I was 180 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I maintained that weight all the way through. And I was in pretty good shape with the troops, because you would have to get up and run with them, every day and not look tired or whatever.
Right.
They were ready to drop dead, and you were ready to go again. So, as I said, we were in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had the opportunity for an early out to go back to college.
Right.
And I took advantage of that and got out in January. So I got out 2 months, 2 months earlier than the tour was up. So I went back to school, and that was a trip because that was the height of the student protests and everything. So that was interesting too.
Right.
But no, I didn't have any problems readjusting to anything. There was no, maybe something's wrong with me, I don't know. But suffice to say that things went pretty much, pretty easy for me.
Yes, sir.
So.
All right. Well,
maybe because I always kept busy, I think that's why.
Okay. All right. Did you follow the war pretty closely through the media after you returned?
Yeah, every night you saw, you couldn't help but not.
Okay.
You would pretty much follow it. I think that the biggest part was at the end of the war when we left. That was hard to take.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Hard to take.
Right. All right.
I think that's what cemented my pro-military, extremely conservative values at the time, because I saw what was happening to the military and to our government. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Well, speaking of that, I know you mentioned a little bit earlier about going back to college and the war protests on the campus there. Could you talk a little bit more about that and about your impression of the war protests there?
Well, back at school, there was about, 6 or 7 of us that were Vietnam veterans or veterans themselves, not necessarily Vietnam veterans, but veterans, Air Force people or other people that were stationed, in Europe or whatever. But there was about four or five of us that were Vietnam veterans.
Yes, sir.
And people sort of left us alone.
Okay.
Because I think they were afraid, you know, and we didn't change that impression. We kind of there was one guy that I became very friendly with, and he was a Vietnam veteran. But he was also, founded the Black Student Organization at the school I was in.
Okay.
And he was, at the time, you know, Black Liberation, you know, Black Panther Party, and, you know, close to them. But we became good friends, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
We disagreed on everything politically, but we were still good friends. But I don't know how that happened.
Right.
He just recently passed away, by the way.
Mm.
And he remained a friend, you know, right up until the day he died. So.
Yes, sir.
But it was interesting. My cousin also, my girl cousin, went to school and graduated the same time. She was a year younger than me, but she had started a year in school before I came back.
Okay.
So we ended up graduating at the same time, and she was a quote hippie.
Okay.
At the time, and we were diametrically opposed on everything, you know, there, but we also became friends.
Hmm.
I mean, well, not became friends, but we also stayed friends.
Okay.
And I became friendly with a lot of people, you know, a lot of the hippies, and a lot, you know, I became friends with just about everybody, and it was interesting. I ran for student class president and was elected twice, you know, junior class and senior class president.
Oh, wow, good.
And most of the people that voted for me were the, you know, the left-leaning pinko commie bedwetters.
Right.
So, but it was very interesting. I remember when we first got there, there was a thing called moratorium thing.
Okay.
They wanted to put the flag down half mast. And I think there was five of us there. Five of the veterans stood around the bottom of the flag, and it was about, oh, maybe 600, 700 other students that were in the mobilization that wanted to put the student mobilization organization that wanted to put the flag down for moratorium day.
Uh-huh. Right.
And five of us stood around the bottom and said, that flag is going to stay up there. It ain't coming down.
Mm, right.
And if you want to take it down, you're going to have to go to us. The president of college came over to me and said, listen, they want to put the flag down. We want to put the flag down. I said, Dr. O'Brien, that flag is going to stay right where it is, and it's about time that you listen to other points of view in this institution. It's not coming down.
Mm-hmm.
And the policemen, they called the police and whatever, the police were there, they were all on our side.
Right.
Anyway, needless to say, the flag stayed up.
Uh-huh. Right.
So, that was my claim to fame against the angry mobs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
To say our claim to fame, because there was five of us there.
Right. All right.
So, but as I said, it was interesting. I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. All right.
But it was, you wanted to change things, and if you want to change things, and try to change things, and some things were, and some things weren't.
Right.
Which leads me up to today, where I'm now 64 years old, and I'm running for town councilman in my town, along with, three other people.
Mm-hmm.
Who are also lifelong residents of this town.
Okay.
This town's going to hell in a handbasket, and we just want to rectify a lot of the problems, so that's why we're running.
Right. Yes, sir.
It's the first time that I ever dabbled in politics, per se. I mean, I've always been involved in politics, but always behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Never for an elected office.
All right. So is the election in November then?
Yep.
All right.
September 2nd.
Yes, sir. All right.
And we, this is in a, the whole town is entirely Democratic. Democrat.
Right.
And we're running, you know, an uphill battle, but we're going to do good because property taxes in this town, 9 years of Democratic administration, property taxes in this town have risen 90%.
Oh, wow.
So people are just really pissed off.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So we have a pretty good chance.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, before wrapping the interview up, I'd like to ask you about that reunion, how that all came about, and also about the book and how it came about as well.
Well, it was, you know, it was interesting, as I said, because we had purchased an Apple IIgs, I think it was, for our kids' a computer. Way back when they were in school, and you know, it was new technology. I didn't want to have anything to do with computers, and my wife, you know, didn't so much either care about it. But the kids, they had to have the computer. They had it out of the box and up and running before we knew what was going on.
Right.
I mean, it shows you how much they're not afraid of technology or whatever. We're petrified of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was embarrassed into using the computer for simple things and whatever by my daughter, and I started, you know, hunting and pecking with the keyboard and got involved, and then I came across an old journal that I had kept. Actually, what happened was first, because all through the war and the years after, I never heard anything at all. I never saw anything about airboats.
Right.
And I said, you know, somebody ought to write a book about this. So I thought about it, and I said, you know, the only person, you know, could write about it are people who lived it. And I lived it, and so why don't I do it? I said, well, I don't know. So I started, you know, I was going through some old stuff, an old duffel bag that I had. And in the duffel bag I had the journal. Mm-hmm. And I started the journal the day I got to Vietnam. And I kept it up for about 2 or 3 months after that. Then
okay.
I stopped writing it. And I'm sorry that I did that. But at least it gave me a starting point for the book. So I did that. And then coupled with paperwork that I had in the Army, certain dates, certain awards that I had were given, I pieced together sort of a timeline. And if you read the book, that's how the book is based. It's based on a timeline with vignettes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I started, you know, writing it and came up with a dead end. But at the same time, I said, geez, you know, let me see if I can get a hold of some people. I had met one of my buddies years ago, had relatives in a town. He was from Buffalo, New York. And he had relatives in the next town over. And so when he got married, he came down to visit those relatives, and we got in contact. And that was 2 years, I guess, after we got back from Vietnam. And then I lost contact with him, believe it or not.
Okay.
And then, as I said, I started writing things, you know, down, hunting and pecking on the computer, you know, little notes and whatever. And I said, geez, let me try and contact Phil and a couple other people if I could try and get people together to see if they remember certain things or what their stories are, so on and so forth. And that would really fill in the blanks. Maybe they had paperwork or whatever at certain times that they got things and they remember dates, or you know, it would help me a little bit.
Right.
Book, so I started looking for Phil and I couldn't find him.
Hmm.
And I said, how could he just disappear? He fell off the face of the earth and nobody knew what he was. I also knew this other guy that was from Rhinebeck, New York. So I contacted him and managed to get a hold of him.
Mm,
And then he knew somebody, a friend of a friend, you know, that was in our unit. And I contacted him, and one buddy led to another buddy, led to another buddy, and that's how it started, to get everybody back together.
Right.
And I said, when are we going to do this? I said, I had met with my partner, basically, on the boats, and when we were on the boats, was a man named Dan Lennon, and he lived in San Diego, California.
Okay.
And Rick Rumsey was in contact with him, and that's how he put us together. So then Danny was so happy that him and his wife got on a plane and came to Newark and visited us. And then when we all went up to Rhinebeck to visit Rick Rumsey, so the three of us we hadn't seen each other in 35 years.
Right.
And it was just like yesterday. You know?
Yes, sir.
Well, we were all brothers, and it was really an amazing experience. And Rick Cabin, you know, we should have a reunion. We should try to get everybody. And Jim, you know, because I wasn't working at the time. I had retired because of my MS and stuff. And Jim, why don't you run it? You know, you've made some contacts with a few people already, and let's do it that way.
Right.
So he said, so I did. And that's how the reunion got started as far as contacting different people.
Yes, sir.
And that was a story in itself.
Right.
And what was really, really heartwarming was my platoon sergeant's widow getting a hold of her.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was difficult, to say the least, to get her because, after I got a hold of a lot of people, then I heard about that there was a department in the Veterans Administration where you could write to, and they would contact the people if they were in the VA system. But they wouldn't give them. You know, you had to self-address the envelope and put all of the stuff in that you wanted. You know, you wanted them to respond to or whatever.
Right.
And they would send it to them, but they wouldn't give you the address.
Okay.
So I said okay, and there was three or four letters that I had sent out informing this reunion, trying to get a hold of them, and they in turn, sent them out if they were in the system.
Right.
Well, my platoon sergeant's widow was in the system as a survivor. As a dependent survivor of somebody who was killed in action.
Right.
And she got the letter, and in the letter I spoke, I said who we were and what we were doing, and we'd really like you to come to this reunion. And for the longest time, and she received it, by the way, on Christmas Eve day before Christmas Eve, which was interesting too.
Right.
But she didn't respond right away because she skeptical of people that were, you know, preying upon victims and Vietnam veteran wives and families and whatever that weren't. Well, she had a lot of problems, but then she saw my name when on the letter. Now she had a picture that her husband had of myself and him in the picture.
Yep.
I was the only person that was ever identified to her in the unit that she ever had.
Mm, right.
So she decided to, and this was all done by email, by the way, and she decided to contact me by email.
Okay.
So we had some email correspondence back and forth, and finally she told me where she was. She lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I said, listen, she had a lot of questions because her husband's body was never recovered. And,
right.
You know, the Army never told her, other than the fact that he was killed, you know, there was no details or anything.
Right.
So that was one of her questions, and I said, listen, you know, she had a lot of questions and a lot of mysteries that surrounded his death, and she wanted the answers. And I said, you know, come to the thing, and all your questions and all the mysteries and everything, you know, any questions you have, you know, either I or somebody else that was there will tell you exactly what happened, so on and so forth. So.
Right.
Make a long story short, I called her on the phone because I got tired of, you know, talking through email, and I didn't know what she sounded like, or I really wanted to talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
She had a wife and two kids, by the way, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was killed, so. But anyway, we started talking, and we strung up a very warm conversation, and ended up, you know, we would fly her to, you know, to D.C., because that's where we were having the reunion.
Right.
And at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And she said, oh, don't worry about that. I'll meet you there. Just, you know, tell me when, where. And because I booked the Washington Hotel, that's where we all were staying. And I booked rooms for everybody, and we all would meet there. And sure enough, she was there, and boy, what an experience that was, too.
Mm. Yes, sir.
And then all of the others that I got a hold of met there. And like I told you, it was unbelievable. I mean, everybody, you know, looked older, and some had beards, some didn't. And I was in my power chair at the time, and I thought that I would be the only one that was, you know, in bad shape or couldn't walk. But there was everybody had problems. One problem or another. Some people had cancer. Some people had neuropathy, peripheral neuropathy, and their kids had problems. All of this was due to exposure to Agent Orange too, which is another part of the story.
Mm. Yes, sir.
And none of them, managed to get a hold of the VA and did anything at the time. So. We got them going to the VA, and as a result, all of them were, you know, received compensation and help from the VA. So that was good. But it was, as I said, it was a really heart-rendering experience. By the way, this guy, Phil, that I said, that from Buffalo, New York, who we couldn't find.
Yes, sir.
Well, the reason we couldn't find him was because he got us into drugs and his next door neighbor was also into drugs and was trying to steal his stash.
Mm.
And he shot him.
Right.
And the kid went back home to his house, and Phil followed and said to his parents, "He got shot. He needs help. I just, you know, shot him," so on. And the parents just ignored him. And anyway, the kid bled out and died.
Mm.
And Phil was convicted of, first-degree manslaughter. And he was sentenced to 8 years in Attica.
Right.
So that's why, you know, we lost contact initially. And then while he was in there, he found Jesus, I guess, and became very involved with other prisoners and God, so to speak, and was very instrumental in bringing a lot of people back to the Lord, and he was granted parole for his exceptional help with the prisoners and how he handled certain things, and then he got out early, and then a friend of his got him into a divinity school.
Mm-hmm.
He became a preacher, and he lives in, he's a minister of Four Square Church in Fitchburg, Massachusetts.
Oh, wow. Wow, how about that?
So, it's interesting, and you would never think that he would be one of those people that would, you know, ever end up as a preacher.
Yes, sir.
So that was interesting.
Right.
Everybody's background was everybody from all over the country. We lived in, we covered California, we had two or three people. We had Alaska. That's where my platoon sergeant was from. And we had Michigan. We had Georgia. We had New Jersey. We had New York State. We had Missouri. We had Louisiana. We had Texas.
Mm-hmm.
We had Arizona. I mean, it was, you know. And everybody that I managed to get a hold of turned out pretty good. Another thing that was interesting too,
yep.
On one of these letters that we sent to the VA, and they would send out to, I got this letter back, and it was my envelope, and said, a person no longer at this address, because they had addressed it, the VA had addressed it and sent it to him, but I had my return address on the envelope.
Right.
The letter had come back to me, and I looked at the address on there, and it had a street in Fresno, California. Well, the street's name in Fresno, California, my brother-in-law also lives on that same street.
Right.
But the street, however, is divided by a 6-lane highway. So one's south and one's north. Well, he lived on the other one.
Okay. But
his wife worked in a bank in Fresno. And I asked her to do a little bit of... I was amazed when I saw the address. I said, oh, my God. Talk about a small world. So I had him do some detective work, and he couldn't find the guy. And then, so I asked his wife, who worked in the bank, if she could find out. Well, he had passed away.
Mm.
And
right.
Social Security had, I guess that she found out through the banking records and whatever.
Right.
That he had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was interesting, because it was like only a highway, across a highway away, for 35 years or whatever, 30 years, they lived together.
Right.
My brother-in-law and this guy.
Yes, sir.
And two of the other people, there's one, two, three people that we didn't find, we never found. There's one person that we never found initially for our reunion. However, one day I'm sitting here about a little over, almost 2 years ago now, and this woman happened to see a copy of my book on the internet, and she said she wrote me an email. My husband's buddy was in airboats, and I want to get him a book, and they went in the buddy system on the Army, but when they got to Vietnam, they went different ways, because my buddy, my husband didn't want to go on into the airboats, and his friend did. So I said, well, what's your friend's name? She goes, it's Jim Hurley. Well, Jim Hurley was in an ambush just after I got back from R&R, and he was severely wounded. In fact, they all thought he was probably going to die. But I never did get back to him. Come to find out that Jim Hurley did recover, and his face was shot, his jaw was shot, his shot in the back and the arm, and whatever, he was caught in a real bad ambush. And he was so bad that the people on the boat with him didn't think he was going to make it. But he did, and she said, yeah, he just retired. He was a history teacher in right outside of Portland, Oregon. And I said, you got to be kidding me. So, here's his number, call him up, and sure enough, and if you look in the book, you'll see a picture of him standing at the bar that we built in base camp in
all right.
Bearcat base camp. It's probably on towards the end, but it's you have the book in front of you?
Yes, sir, I do.
It's the about 143.
Okay.
You see a guy in a white shirt, you can just about make him out sitting at the bar?
Right, right.
Well, that's me.
Okay.
And the sergeant is Harry Walton. He just died. He died about a year ago of lung cancer. And the guy, big guy on the end, is Jim Hurley.
Okay.
That's the guy who was missing. We never did find him, so we thought he was gone, but I found him two years ago.
Right.
Just by a freak of nature, and he was, as I said, he was a history teacher in, I guess, Forest Grove, I think is the name of the town. And I have to update this book, by the way. And we found him, and then I put him in touch with everybody, and everybody was going nuts about that. And, we happened to find him, and he was as good as new. He wasn't really bad, but boy, oh boy, from what I understand, his face was gone and his head was gone. But it didn't appear that way. They did a good job, I guess, in the hospitals.
Right.
But he was in the hospitals for about 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Before he got out. And as I said, he went back to school and became a history teacher in Portland. And not Portland, but in a local high school, and he had just retired.
Wow.
So.
Yes, sir.
Now, you think you found everybody you could, and all of a sudden people turn up. I hope that's going to happen with a couple of the other people we couldn't find either.
Right. So. Yes, sir.
And everybody keeps saying, well, when are you going to have another one? When are you going to have another reunion? Get everybody together. And, I said, well, I don't know. When I get up enough energy to do another one, maybe we'll do it some place in the Midwest or California. So I don't know. I gotta worry about my daughter's wedding because she's getting married October 2nd.
Oh wow, that's coming up.
And that's right in the middle of the campaign too. So
right, yes sir.
It's gonna be very hectic.
Certainly sounds like it. Well, is there anything else we should cover? Anything else you'd like to say before we bring the interview to a close?
No, as I said, it's a shame that we couldn't get a hold of everybody. I know a couple of them probably are dead, but it was interesting to see what everybody, what people have turned out doing and what their lives are like, since Vietnam. And,
right.
That to me is, doing this and this was really, in writing this book, at the reunion, a lot of stuff in this book was from that reunion, too, because people remember things that, you know, you can't possibly remember, and then they, you know, you tell them some things that they can't remember, and it was really, without all of them together, this book couldn't have been written.
Yes, sir.
Couldn't have been written. Oh, another interesting, this is even more interesting.
Okay.
I think this is fabulous. I found out through a guy who started in the Air Force and really became we threw him out of the platoon initially after our training because he was really a dud.
Okay.
And he was from Washington State. And one day, that's another thing that started me on this quest to find people, because he had posted some questions on the 9th Division website about airboats.
Right.
And I read this, and I read his name, and I said, who the hell is this guy? I don't remember this guy. You know, but he said some of the things, and some dates, and some of the things that happened, that if you were only there, that's the only way you would know them. So I bit the bullet and said, okay, well, I'll give him a call. So I gave him a call and talked to him, and sure enough, he was the guy that we had thrown out, but my platoon leader at the time had thrown out because he was a dud.
Mm-hmm.
And sent him back to a line unit.
Right.
Where, by the way, he distinguished himself and he also was severely wounded at the time. Before, you know, with this unit.
Right.
But anyway, he had told me he was in touch with a Norman Stone. Norman Stone was our platoon leader.
Mm, right.
And he had said, well, yeah, Norman had this videotape of our unit. I said, what do you mean? What are you talking about, a videotape? There was, you know, videotapes weren't invented at the time. So, but he gave me his number and his address. So he was one of the initial people that I called.
Right.
He lives in Southington, Connecticut, about an hour and a half away from where I live.
Okay.
And, you know, I was totally, you know, amazed that he lived so close, and in that time we had never, you know, run across each other or thought about it. But anyway, and then I asked him, I said, you know, I talked to this guy in Washington State, and he said you had a tape. Oh, yeah, I got a videotape.
Huh.
How the hell did you get a videotape? He says, well, my mother was watching a news program, and there was a clip on airboats that the BBC had produced.
Hmm.
And she knew that her son was in charge of airboats, so she wrote the BBC and asked them if they could send her a film of that, because they'd be 8mm film or whatever.
Right.
So they said, yeah, we can do that, and they sent it to her. Well, he had since, you know, when he got home and he retrieved it and whatever, had it made into a videotape. And I said, wow, could you send me a copy of the video? He said, sure, no problem. So he sent it to me. And my family were all sitting down watching it when it came in, and sure enough, it was a picture of the videotape. And there was one scene in there when all of a sudden my daughter said, hey, Dad, that's you.
Right?
Talking about it, you know. That's you. Sure enough, it was me.
Oh, wow.
And it was a picture of me. See, I was the lieutenant's driver.
Right.
The airboat, because he, you know, I mean, he was the driver of the airboat, and I was on a machine.
Right.
And you know the picture you see of George Washington crossing the Delaware?
Right. Yes, sir.
River with his leg up on the boat.
Right.
Well, I was speaking on a machine gun with my leg up on a boat. It looked like George Washington crossing the Delaware.
Right.
And I couldn't believe it. And then it went to another scene, and finally it came to the end where the before our boats would come in for landing. And they had film coming in for landing, and sure enough, I was on one of the boats on the machine gun, and because the lieutenant hit gravel right away, the boat sort of bounced when he brought the boat in, and and I sat down very hard on the thing. So
right.
As a matter of fact, in my book in a dedication, I said thank you, Lieutenant. But and my derriere thanks you too for at least being alive, but you're a lousy driver.
Right.
Anyway, how many Vietnam veterans can say that they have actual film or videotape of themselves in Vietnam?
I would bet there aren't many.
I was amazed.
Yes, sir.
So I had other people doing it, and then I sent everybody a copy of that, copy saved, sent everybody a copy. Everybody was amazed.
Right.
So that was amazing.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
So I guess that's everything. It's amazing how things happen. I guess that's what I'm saying, because things you don't know and don't expect always turn up. Well, this was real blockbuster. This really, the clip was only about 3 minutes long, 4 minutes long.
Right.
But I mean, something? I think I sent a copy of that videotape to Texas Tech.
Oh, really?
Along with the book.
Okay. I'll have to check and see.
Check it out. I think I did. I'm not sure.
All right. Let me check and see about that.
The BBC was doing a story on America's allies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the allies that we had in the Vietnam War. And they were focusing on the Thais. And because the Thais were working with us, that's why they did it, I guess.
Right. Yes, sir. All right. Well, I don't believe we've actually mentioned the name of the book for the recording for the future, in case people are listening to this.
Yeah, the book was called The Bamboo Shoot, the Story of the Second Air Bolt Attempt.
All right. And for people listening, future listeners of this, where can they get a copy of it?
They can get it at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble online, both of them online.
Okay.
They can get it. They can't just walk into a store, although as wish as hard as I might, they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
They can't.
Right.
Because it wasn't a big seller.
Okay.
But you can purchase either the hardcover or the soft cover.
All right. Well,
but you can get it from the publisher, Ex Libris, too.
Okay.
Forgot about that.
All right. Well, anything else before bringing the interview to a close?
No, I don't think so. I think we've pretty much covered everything.
All right.
Other than the fact that, the day I got home from Vietnam was the day I met my wife.
Oh, okay.
I don't know whether that's interesting or not.
Sure.
The funny part of it is a very good friend of mine was having a rehearsal dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived across from where we used to hang out. And I was hanging out, just waiting for somebody to come along. And he came out from across the street and said, "Jim, come on over." And I said, "Yeah," and I was, all these people were there, and he was having a, as they said, he was having his rehearsal. He said, "I didn't know you were going to be home. You still had time left in Vietnam. You're coming to the wedding anyway." So he invited me to the wedding,
mm-hmm.
And he said, "Gene," I said, "these are all your college friends. I don't know anybody." "Don't worry about it. I'll sit you at Madeline's table. You'll know everybody in 10 minutes.
Right.
So I said, Madeline, you know, I met Madeline at dinner that night, and sure enough, I sat at Madeline's table. I ended up taking home one of the other bridesmaids. So then a couple of weeks later, I came back, and, you know, he had just gone off to Purdue with his wife for, he was pursuing a PhD in audiology.
Okay.
And he was going to Purdue, and, you know, it was good for him. His mother was like my second mother. And I was over at the house one night, and Madeline happened to be over there, too, talking to them and whatever. Then I asked her out, and one thing led to another, and, you know, 40 years later, here I am.
Yes, sir.
But other than that, that's basically it. That's, yeah, that's basically it. As I said, I don't want to dwell too much on my MS, but that also gave me the time to write the book, too.
Yes, sir.
Because I wasn't working, I couldn't work, but I could still punch a key or two on a computer, so.
Right.
That's what started me on this.
Yes, sir.
So, what do they say when something bad happens? There's always something that, you know, that might not, you might not see it as bad, or it might happen bad to you, but there's always good in it.
Yes, sir.
I don't know what the exact quote is, but.
Well, all right then. Well, I will go ahead and bring the interview to a close.